Thank you, Steve. It's us. Hi, guys. It's Bill and Wendy, and we're thrilled that you're here. It's Thursday, 312-981-7200. Can I just quickly, before anything else happens, this is not an apology to Steve, but I just want to go back 24 hours in time and tell him, Steve Bertrand, that yesterday at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that there was a wind advisory for a 24-hour period.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, that's no big deal. We've had wind here before.
It's the Windy City, after all.
This is the Windy City, after all.
Not named for that, evidently.
No, it's the politicians. But the wind by me last night was like nothing I had ever experienced before. We were in a wind tunnel last night.
Well, we tried to advisory you, Bill, that it was coming.
I will from now on heed those warnings.
Right.
Did you lose anything?
No, but it sounded like, seriously, I don't know if it was that bad by you, because I talked to Kevin, our producer. He said there was almost nothing.
Really?
Yeah.
It was just gusty. It wasn't like out of control.
You know what? He was lost in a card game.
That must have been it, a Magic the Gathering game.
That would have blown the cards off the table, though. That wouldn't have worked.
This year, for the first year in many years, my lawn this weekend had it. It was pristine. Not a leaf on it. You know, and
what's
we put
it look like now?
Well, we put our leaves at the curb, and then the village comes and sucks them up.
Yep.
And
the big snuffle up, I guess.
I was stalking the sucking machine yesterday. It was like 2 blocks away. Honest to God. And I'm like, if you would just make it here. And, of course, they didn't. So
it was really bad. And, again, we have this dead tree in our backyard. Mm-hmm. And we have probably a 10-foot branch that fell down in the middle of the yard.
But no damage other than the branch falling.
The hammock has been taken down, but it was wet, so it was hanging on the side of the porch.
Yeah.
For 3 weeks. Not that I'm passive-aggressive or anything, but that blew into the center of the yard.
It did.
And our garbage cans blew around, and even Tiki was, he looked like a mime dog walking against the wind last night.
I swear to you, we have a rabbit. My daughters have a rabbit, but one of my daughters is in Costa Rica, and the other's away at school. And I felt sorry for the rabbit because you could hear
What's
the rabbit.
What's happened to you? You
I
sing
know.
On the radio and you're feeling
and
sorry
feel bad
for a pet.
I know. It was very alarming. I could hear the rabbit running around afraid because the wind was so loud. And where the rabbit is situated in Kylie's room, the windows just kept like
rattling.
Shaking and shaking and shaking. So, I didn't, and I'm not, I don't know what to do for a rabbit in such...
Hold it, comfort it, talk sweetly to
it. I felt badly for it.
Hello, little bunny,
there wasn't going to be any of that.
Boil carrots in front of it.
That's all you can do sometimes, is boil carrots.
Invite Glenn Close over.
There's really countless opportunities here.
Next time I'm in this situation.
But animals do freak out when it's like this, because this was... This was a little bit worse than I recall.
And Steve warned us. He said...
You laughed at him. I said, ready.
Please. I know wind. Wind's not going to scare me. And they call the wind, Wendy, what do they call the wind?
Mariah.
They call the wind Mariah. I said, Mariah's not going to scare me. I'm a grown man. Unless needles are blown my way, I'm going to be fine. But the wind was so scary last night.
Yeah, I just want to correct you. I didn't warn you. I advised you.
It was an advisory.
It was an advisory.
It was,
right? It was not
a wind
warning.
Advisory.
No, yeah, it wasn't a panic. And it rained like crazy. Did it rain by you, too?
For a little while. Just maybe for 8 minutes, 10 minutes at the most.
If I can just tell you something, for years, anytime it rained, the storm sewers can't keep up in our antiquated sewer system in the town I live in.
Yeah.
And all the streets, the intersections are completely underwater. And when that happens, we would get, honestly, 2 feet of water in our basement.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Called PermaSeal. This is a true testament. It was so awesome to walk downstairs.
The same PermaSeal that advertises right here on this station?
Yeah, but I mean, for years I've heard Roy Spencer talking about it, and I said, oh, it's too expensive for me because I needed everything they offer.
Right.
It is money well spent.
Yep.
Michael has a bunch of amps down there because he plays guitar. We have a drum kit. Jim has his makeshift studio down there. We have so many things. I bought a new rug. Not one speck of water. And the neighbors were flooded.
Well, you did the right thing.
I know. It was really exciting. I'm serious, because you'd hear the rain and the wind, and then you'd dread walking down the basement stairs going, what am I walking into?
It's going to be a waterfall downstairs.
It was awesome.
Yeah?
It was awesome.
They're a good sponsor. I know you used to have to make boats out of my pillows, also a sponsor, but now you don't have to do that anymore.
I'm just telling you, it is really an amazing thing. Yeah. So I got to tell you, I hope everyone survived. I know ComEd was putting extra operators.
Were there power outages? I don't
there
even know.
Were,
there
and were, and there still are.
Oh, there are.
You know, I was
because
waiting for
of the wind.
Yeah, man, it's blowing trees down. There were branches down. It was really. Do we have how fast they were going? Do we have
the miles per hour rating? I don't know.
Well,
don't know.
They were gusting this morning. Like no, like 40, 45.
Is that bad?
Well, I don't know what the tops were, but earlier today,
my late night wiffle ball league game was canceled.
Too bad the wind wasn't going out because you would have sent that thing.
I would have hit more home runs. You know, my best friend in the world, Grant Mulvey, once hit five. He had five goals in a game. I could have had six home runs in my wiffle ball game last night, but no, it was canceled just for safety reasons. We didn't want trouble.
You are a goof with a capital goo.
Thank you. That's
that is a compliment.
That's very kind. That's very kind of you.
All right. Well, we hope all of you have your power back.
And yes.
I guess the stream is down, too. People are texting.
Oh, it is.
WGNradio.com. You can stream
wind,
it on the app.
Not
yep.
The stream down.
How about that? The wind blows the stream.
I guess it does. Yeah. My favorite nursery rhyme has just come back to bite me. All right. How about this? A quick break and then a lot more show ahead. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
I love my MyPillow. I really, 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 truly
do.
It's
good stuff.
This week, Chicago's Best answers the age-old question, which side is the best side? It's a North Side versus South Side food face-off Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. Glamour Magazine, you've heard of it.
I know Glamour Magazine, sure.
I still like it, although there are too many ads. I know people say that about radio.
Yeah.
But there are too many ads. I want the articles. I'm
going
to start reading Playboy, since there'll be more articles and less naked women.
Yep.
Last night, Glamour Magazine held its 25th annual Glamour Woman of the Year Award, celebrating powerful honorees like Reese Witherspoon,
yeah,
Victoria Beckham, and Caitlyn Jenner.
Oh, how about that?
And Caitlyn Jenner did a little interview with Glamour. I'm getting this off of BuzzFeed. We sat down with Caitlyn Jenner backstage at Carnegie Hall to hear her brilliant words of wisdom. And here was a question that was asked. What was the moment that you felt most proud to be a woman in 2015?
That's a good question.
And Caitlyn said, over the last 6 months, it's really been a progression. I have found that women have so much unleashed power that they don't really utilize because they don't have confidence in themselves about who they are and what they can do. Again, this is Caitlyn Jenner saying, I have always actually been with and attracted to very strong women, and I think I've learned a lot from them. The power of the woman has just not been unleashed around the world.
I imagine part of the transformation that formerly Bruce Jenner, now Caitlyn Jenner, is experiencing are things just like that, where everything is different, you know?
But it's not because she's a woman.
Right.
It's because she's a man who became a woman. That's where she's having a difficult time.
Yeah. Yeah. But just the perception, just the way that daily life treats you as a person has got to be dramatically different as a man and as a woman, I would imagine. And I don't know who would know more about it than somebody like Caitlyn Jenner, who has been both. You know what I mean? You know how when somebody has a certain hair color, like I'm sure you've had a friend that was a brunette her whole life and then all of a sudden went, I'm going to try something and be a blonde. And even something as subtle as your hair color being different, just the world treats you slightly different because your hair is a different color.
Yeah,
so
but
think
she
about
doesn't
this.
Really know what it's like to be a natural
I agree with
born
that,
born woman.
Too. Right.
She never had her period.
Right. Right.
She never had menstrual cramps.
Yep.
She never had, she could have shaved her arms. But, I mean, all these things that, you know, giving birth.
Right.
These, I mean, I'm not saying she is. I just want you to listen to this.
All right.
They asked her, what's the hardest part for you about being a woman? And this is what Caitlyn Jenner says.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I take issue with. The hardest part about being a woman is figuring out what to wear. That is so not true.
I bet that's not even close to the worst.
It's always that way. I never thought it would come to this. I had really no sense of style. Everyone around me and my family had the sense of style. I learned as much as I possibly could, but it's more than that. I'm kind of at this point in my life where I'm trying to figure this woman thing out,
yeah,
womanhood thing out, and it's more than hair, makeup, clothes, and all that kind of stuff. Duh.
Yeah, it would be difficult to think that that would be the hardest part of being a woman, is just picking out what you're going to wear that day. That seems...
I think it's fascinating that Glamour picked a woman of the year, and her comment was that it's hard to figure out what to wear, right? Had it been any other woman...
Right. You would pounce on them, wouldn't you?
Yep.
Normally?
And I good for her. You need to be happy inside with who you are. And I'm totally for the transformation.
Mm-hmm.
You can't comment on being, you make me feel like a natural woman. I am a natural woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, I should spend a little more time thinking about what I wear.
Well, all right. May I ask, does this figure into it? Caitlyn Jenner has only been a woman for 7 or 8 months, right? So maybe, just maybe, she may not have enough time spent to know what really is the hardest part of being a woman. You know?
Yeah, I
is
don't
that
know.
Possible?
Yeah, that's possible.
It does seem.
She doesn't have a right to say that yet. And really, there are just gawky stages that girls go through when they're trying to blossom into a young woman, and she didn't experience any of that.
If Glamour magazine had picked you as their woman of the year, or one of their women of the year, your answer to that same question, they say to you, Wendy, what is the hardest part of being a woman? Your answer is what?
The pressure of taking care of everyone, including myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would say the hardest part of being a woman is.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause
there's pressure on you. My son needs a haircut. I have to call and make an appointment. Jim offered to do it, and he said, what day? I'm like, I don't know. I got to check my calendar. And he said, could you just call?
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of things to keep organized, especially when you're a woman who has a husband and kids.
Right.
And every woman goes through this, and they'll attest to it. That is really very difficult.
Can you imagine if Sarah Palin had said the hardest thing about being a woman is choosing what to wear?
She'd be done that day, right? That would be the day that she'd be... People would go, oh, you can't take her seriously. She thinks that's the hardest part of being a woman.
It is not the hardest part.
Or Hillary Clinton.
Well, right, but
Or Sandra Day O'Connor, or the list goes on and on.
Yeah, but the left would pounce on Sarah Palin like...
Oh, yeah,
know,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It would never end.
Yeah.
Well, Caitlin, so glad you got Glamour's Woman of the Year. And I mean that sincerely.
What's she wearing in the picture?
She looks great. Bill and I were looking at her. She's wearing a lovely royal blue dress with a black collar and a very low neckline. It's not showing cleavage, but it's low in the sense that it's off the shoulder a little bit.
Yeah.
She looks very classy and very pretty.
Yeah. Would you have put...
Still has man hands, if you want to know the truth.
The hands are bigger than you would anticipate for... Right, I get that.
Although I've been told I have man hands, too, so whatever.
Oh. Would you put choosing what to wear that... Did she say choosing what to wear that day, or how did she word it? Just picking what you wanted to wear, that's what she said?
Hardest part about being a woman... The hardest part for you about being a woman, and she said, the hardest part is figuring out what to wear. I never thought it would come to this. I had no sense of style.
Would that even be in your top 10?
No.
Of the hardest things about being a woman?
No.
It isn't, right? All right.
But she does go on to say, I'm trying to figure this womanhood thing out. It's more than hair, makeup, clothes, and all that kind of stuff, which goes against what she said.
A little bit.
There's an element here that I'm still kind of searching for, and I think that'll take a while, because I think as far as gender, we're all on a journey. We're all learning and growing about ourselves, and I feel the same way.
Huh.
And cheers to her for saying that, because she is on a new journey now. And
right.
But, the hardest...
And they do word it, to be fair, they say, for you, what's the hardest part of being a woman?
Guess.
So maybe it is for her. Maybe that is the hardest part.
I just wanted women to come to my defense and say what the hardest part of their lives are, and
yeah.
No one called.
Oh,
so
oh.
I guess I'm a complainer.
No, please. Don't even. All right. A quick break. Steve with the news, and then a lot more going on today's show. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy, and it's WGN. Thank you, Steve. I'm going to warn you right now, what we're about to talk about is ridiculous, just so you know, just in case you're wondering when you hear us discuss this, if you're saying to yourself, well, this is ridiculous, we agree with you. This is ridiculous. It's now become a trend, with the big election coming up a year away.
A year away. That's what...
We're a year away from the presidential
you'd
election.
You'd think it was next week.
By all the debates and all the talk, you would think, right? You hear the big November election, you go, well, that must be, it's now, right? It's this November.
Who's going to remember this next year at
this
time?
Well, maybe it's better they not remember this part of it. It has now become perfectly acceptable to ask any of the candidates if they would or would not go back in time and kill baby Hitler.
Yeah.
Which is the weirdest thing in the world.
We touched on this very briefly yesterday.
I know.
Because Jeb Bush was asked that question, and there's no way to answer that correctly.
Right. It's as hypothetical could be. But now I keep asking myself, because they did. They started out by asking Jeb Bush this question, and then yesterday they asked Ben Carson the question. And we will play you clips of the question, which you already know, and then the answer, which you may or may not already know. But then as I hear this, I say to myself, I'm a fan of science fiction, and it is an interesting concept to be able to time travel and potentially kill or not kill baby Hitler. However, in a situation like this where this... The running for president and being president is a pretty serious job. So why is anybody wasting anybody's time with this question?
Because they lifted it from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Is that what it is? That probably is what it is.
Or Back to the Future. I mean, seriously, this is really ridiculous.
It is. And at the heart of its ridiculousness... There is something to like. I keep wavering back and forth because I go, oh, don't ask a guy who's running for president this, because there are no time machines. You can't go back and kill baby Hitler. You can't. And yet I go, but it would be an interesting idea. So I keep going back and forth. Let's start out with Jeb Bush. This was the other day when a columnist, a writer, asked Jeb Bush whether he would or would not go back in time.
Said if you could go back in time and kill baby Hitler, would you? I need to know.
And
hell yeah, I would.
Even if he was really cute.
No, look, you gotta step up, man. I mean, that would be key. Problem with going back in history and doing that is, as we know from the series, what was the name of the Michael Fox movies?
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future. It could have a dangerous effect on everything else.
There's lots to consider in this.
But I'd do it. I mean, okay. Hitler.
Well, you're down. I mean, there's no backing out now.
So he says, Jeb Bush says, not just that he would do it, but his quote, direct quote, hell yeah, I would. He's all gung-ho to travel back in time and kill baby.
Hell yeah.
Right. That's the Texan in him.
Absolutely.
Right? That's the Texan attitude.
What a goof-ass reporter. You gotta tell me. I gotta know. And then, would you kill baby Hitler? Hell yeah. What if he was cute?
That was another reporter who asked that, but it was, I mean.
Do you guys know who the questioner was?
I do not.
I mean, it almost sounds like, I wonder if it was college.
Oh, somebody like.
I'll see if I can find out. I don't know, because it's.
I do not know who asked that question.
I'm praying.
It was not. I know, right, that it was kind of a semi non-legitimate news source.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think a reporter would say, what if he was really cute?
That was a different reporter.
I know, but still. Dumbest thing I have ever heard. I mean,
right.
And it's, you know, too bad for Jeb Bush. He should have just. Well, first of all, he should have not. You know.
Well, Steve, that's what I'm wondering is, if you're a legitimate candidate for the presidency, do you say to whatever reporter asked that question, with all due respect, do we need to pretend that there's a time machine that will take me back to kill baby Hitler? Should he have said that or just shrugged the question off?
I think he probably should have said it's, you know, not a, you know, I'm not going to, that's not a question for
right.
me. Or, but, you know, then he went on to quote the Back to the Future series, which was.
Right.
I hadn't heard that part of the clip before.
Right.
So he was really engaged.
He goes, what's the name of that Michael Fox movie? All right. So now, because they've asked Jeb Bush this question, you also have to ask Ben Carson the same question, don't you? It only seems fair.
Well, yeah, because it was a really unfair question. You know, God, he should have just said, hey, you're funny.
Right.
And walked away.
That's a better way to handle it, isn't it? All right. So Ben Carson gets asked the same question again, if you're just joining us. If you could go back in time,
hell yeah,
kill baby Hitler. Right. Those are the cards that are showing on the table. Those are the cards you have to beat. Are hell yeah, I would, according to Jeb Bush. But what about Ben Carson? He's very he's gentle Ben, Wendy. Ben Carson is a very gentle human being. Would he go back in time and kill baby Hitler?
Carson, as perhaps the most anti-Hitler, but also the most anti-abortion candidate, would you be in favor of aborting baby Hitler?
Oh my God.
I'm not in favor of boarding anybody.
Mr. Not even Hitler. Okay.
Do you think that you were let
pro Hitler?
All right. So that Jeez. No, as ridiculous as that was, it was the last second where the guy who asked the question then decided that because Ben Carson would not travel back in time to kill baby Hitler, that he was pro-Hitler. He announced that you are then pro-Hitler because he wouldn't go back in time.
There's no way to answer that question, so you don't answer it.
Right. I know that.
You know what? You know, in my opinion, who answered it best? Jeb Bush. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Let's go get him.
Kill that baby. I don't care if it's cute.
I'd start zipping up my jacket and arming up. I'd be ready. Where's that time machine, I'd say?
And the question came from New York Times Magazine. They had a poll. New York Times Magazine, the question came from a poll on their website or Twitter site. So I don't know who asked it, but it was someone from the New York Times Magazine.
There was some anthology series years and years ago, and I want to say it was either Tales from the Dark Side or Tales of the Unexpected. It was some show with the word tales in it. That's all I remember. But it was one of those shows. Remember, like, after The Twilight Zone and One Step Beyond, you had a lot of different versions of that.
On Channel 9, I used to watch that all the time.
Right. Okay, so do you remember the episode where they showed a woman, a pregnant woman, and all you knew at the time you were watching the episode was it's like turn of the century Germany or something like that, and there's a woman who's having a very difficult pregnancy, and a doctor comes in, and they're trying to decide whether or not it's even worth it to put her through the process of birth because there's a chance that she may die or whatever. And then you find out at the end after she has the baby, they go, what are you going to name the baby? I'm going to name him Adolf.
Adolf. Right. I totally remember that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just want to ask you, I don't remember this. Was the baby cute?
I don't remember whether or not the baby was cute. I like that that was part of the mere fact that somebody thought, I got to ask a follow-up question to the baby Hitler question. I'll ask if baby Hitler was cute or not.
Well, he's saying, you know, hell yeah, I'd kill it. What if he was cute? Right. Would you kill a cute baby, even though it was Hitler?
Then Jeb Bush pulls back. Oh, I didn't even think about that. No, I might not if it was a cute baby Hitler.
I just don't get it. What a stupid question.
I know.
Kudos to that person, though, for getting that question in.
No, quit it. You can't do that.
What?
You can't say stupid question.
It was
kudos
stupid.
For getting it in.
Well, it's a stupid question. Yeah, I can say both. Greg, what do you think?
Well, what if this question makes the next president actually go back in time, but they fail to kill baby Hitler, and that's what causes baby Hitler to be the Hitler we know?
Ah, that takes it even one step further. What if baby Hitler in this scenario would have been a good baby Hitler, but the attempt at baby Hitler's death caused baby Hitler to be upset? Is that what you're saying? Right. The trumpets of baby Hitler doom.
All right, well, someone is saying you don't kill Hitler. He was a leader of men. You educate and mold Hitler to be a good person.
That's better.
Yeah, but you can't come up with that in that quick a time. We've had time to discuss it, and Jeb Bush got the lob first.
Yes.
So if someone just asks you that on the fly, I mean, really, Greg, what would you say? If someone just out of the blue said, hey, if you could time travel, if you could go back in time, would you kill baby Hitler?
I'd have to say no. That would change the whole timeline, and then we might not get the chance to see baby Hitler, and then the whole Earth is destroyed, according to every sci-fi movie out there.
Yeah, you got to keep everything the same. Don't deviate from the original plan. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Did they call baby Hitler when he was a baby?
No, they called him baby Adolf.
Baby Adolf. They didn't call him baby Hitler.
They don't say baby.
All right.
Did he goose crawl as a baby? I'm trying to think of how he moved. He would probably have goose crawled.
I don't approve of that joke.
All right. Thank you.
872 says, easier to go find Hitler's mom before she conceives and kill her.
Oh, interesting. All right.
But what if she's cute?
Well, then you have a problem, don't you? I love that this is a point of contention among the candidates. And I also love that nobody will ask Donald Trump this question because he's the one. As I know, we have a
he'd deport him.
Right.
You're
we'll build a wall
right.
around Germany. I think
No, a wall around Hitler.
Right.
We'll put him in a cement wall playpen.
And we'll
It'll
make Eva Braun pay for the wall. I'll go back in time and make Eva Braun pay for the wall. You can't do that. What about baby Trump? I want to meet baby Trump.
We got to ask if you could go back in time, what would you do with baby Trump? I would deprive him of something so he knows what it's like. I wouldn't just give him the silver spoon.
Right.
All right, Christine, what do you think about all this?
I think it's a ridiculous question. We need to talk about the issues. But in a recent episode of Doctor Who, the writers in the BBC kind of cover this, where the doctor had the opportunity. He landed in a war zone where he had the chance to save a child. And as it turns out, this child was the creator of the worst, most horrible race of monsters in the whole Doctor Who universe.
Huh.
Yeah.
So that was
wrestled with the dilemma. It was the creator of the Daleks.
So would you agree, Christine, that was something of an analogy to somebody like Mussolini or Hitler or something? That's what they were going for, right?
I suppose this is the year of the Daleks for the Doctor Who people. I simply live with Doctor Who people. Oh. I don't know the entire right. thing, but
in a commune, like a whole commune of Doctor Who fans and
no,
a giant TARDIS.
My daughter and husband are Whovian, and I just Whovian, yes,
I like
Whovian.
That.
And I just that's what people who refer to themselves as Doctor Who fans, you know, you're a Chicagoan, you're a Whovian,
right? I get that.
But anyway, yeah, it's possible. I mean, to my understanding, the writers of the show do tend to take things from, bigger modern society questions and kind of, sci-fi
tailor
up
to the show. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was actually a fairly thoughtful episode, if not particularly well written, but it mirrored this, and so that's why I thought I would chime in.
Well, thank you, Christine.
Well, thank you for chiming in.
They did it on Star Trek, too. There was an episode of the original Star Trek where Kirk and Spock had to go back to the 1940s America to change something in history. I don't remember exactly what it was, but saw it when I was a kid. So, I mean, this timeline has been out there for a while. It's just funny that it's become a political issue. Right?
I know. And somebody, three people have said it's Tales from the Crypt that was on.
It probably is Tales from the Crypt. It could be. I knew there was Tales from the Dark Side, there was Tales of the Unexpected,
right.
And there was Tales from the Crypt.
Too many tales.
A lot of tales. I just couldn't remember which.
And
I watched it with Baby Rod Serling. He came to my house, Baby Rod Serling.
Was he smoking then?
Yeah, he was smoking a candy cigarette.
I bet it was
Baby
real.
Rod Serling.
Somebody said Stephen Colbert did a real funny Baby Hitler wrap-up last night, so we're going to look for that during the
right.
commercial break.
All right, good. How about that? All right, a quick break. More show coming your way. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
The Baby Hitler saga rages on here on 720 WGN. Crazy stupid.
It really is, and I know that it's a long, long campaign season, so some of the questions will be better than others, but if you're just joining us, probably the silliest campaign question possibly in the history of politics was asked, both of Jeb Bush and of Ben Carson. The question was, if you could go back in time, would you kill Baby Hitler? I keep vacillating between why would you ask such a stupid question to that is kind of an interesting question. I want to know your answer. And no one's asking Trump.
I would like to hear his answer. I got to be honest with you. Somebody wants to say, Bill, in the Star Trek episode you referenced where you said Kirk and Spock went back in time or something.
Yeah.
Kirk and Spock had to let an influential pacifist die. If she had lived, the U.S. wouldn't have gotten into World War II.
That's exactly what it was. I haven't seen it since I was 8 or 9 years old, but that's exactly what happened. Right.
Someone else messed it up, and Dr. McCoy jumped through a time machine, changed history, so Kirk and Spock had to go back and fix it, or there would be no world as we know it.
Well, maybe. I seem to remember more of the first one than the second, but it could be.
All right, and this is the problem, the dilemma. If you go back in time, should you kill Baby Hitler? 815 says, what if you go back in time to try and kill Hitler's mom but fall in love with her, and then you become Hitler's father?
So that would mirror what happened in Back to the Future, right? Is that what they're going for,
yeah,
I think?
Yeah, that would be bad to be his dad. Because really, how do you put him on a timeout?
I always thought, as much as I liked the Back to the Future trilogy, the weirdness of the fact that there was some attraction between Michael J. Fox, between Marty McFly and his mother when he went back to visit the family, that always weirded me out
just a
little bit.
Right? I agree with you, absolutely.
Everything else about the movies I'm fine with, but whenever I don't watch them real frequently, but whenever I do see a clip, I go, that part's a little bizarre.
A lot of people are texting us, too, that Stephen Colbert did something.
About Baby Hitler?
Yes, and I think we have it.
All right.
To diverge, because I wouldn't kill young Adolf. I would take him from his parents and raise him with love. Hear me out, okay? I would give Hitler a safe, supportive home. All the while, I would watch him like a hawk. I would let him join anything where they have to wear a uniform. No Cub Scouts, no Little League, definitely no marching band. Most importantly, I would teach baby Hitler that we do not solve our problems with violence. And then, if he starts getting mouthy as a teenager, I stick a knife in his ribs and snap off the handle. Okay? And if that attack fails, and the horror of being stabbed by a person he thinks is his father turns him into a monstrous dictator, it's easily fixable. I just go back in time and kill baby me. Ah. You're welcome. We'll be right back.
Wow, how about that?
I think he put it to rest.
Also, there'd be an episode where, as a kid, he would go, hey, I'm trying something new. What do you think of the mustache? And I'd go, I'd grow it out a little bit more. Just a little more on the sides. See what you think. Along the lines of politics, Jeb Bush, if you want to see an awkward video, now I just know we just talked about an awkward question that was asked of Jeb Bush. I don't mean to pick on Jeb Bush, but there's a video that if you haven't seen, you need to see. It's at a rally, a Jeb Bush rally, and you see Jeb Bush trying his best to chest bump a supporter. There's a man who explains to him that he had, this is the Jeb Bush supporter, that for a while he was a supporter of Ted Cruz, but now that he's met Jeb Bush, he is now a supporter of his, of Jeb Bush's. So then Jeb Bush does, I guess, what you do when you're running for president. You know, you could either handshake him or you can chest bump him. So he opts for the chest bump. And Kevin, is it already on our Facebook page or can we put it on? We will, in the next several minutes, put it on our Facebook page. What you'll see is Jeb Bush try his best to do what athletes have been doing for decades, which is the chest bump, but his is not quite good. Are you watching it?
I'm going to watch it in about 2 seconds.
All right.
And
prepare for awkwardness, because the concept of the chest bump is a very easy thing to grasp. You just move your chest toward the other guys, but Jeb Bush is just not suited for it somehow.
It's a way bigger commitment than high-fiving someone or giving them a fist bump. All right, I'm going to do it now with the... Boy, Jeb, it looks old.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It looks contrived.
Okay, that looks like, I'm sorry, it looks like we are visiting a senior center.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, he does not leave the ground.
Right.
He just kind of walks right up and sticks his chest out.
Right.
All right, that was really pathetic.
It didn't work, did it? It was bad.
And I feel bad about him fielding the baby Hitler question. And quite honestly, had I been asked that in a pinch, he'd said the right thing for not being able to think about it.
Yeah.
But the chest bump, oh my God.
Somebody needs to work with him on the chest bump.
It is not even a chest bump. It's just kind of like, I'm going to walk into you.
It's like a low-level collision. It's like if somebody said, all right, you get in your car and you get in your car and drive at a half a mile an hour and crash into each other. That's what you have.
Remember when Tim Conway was the old man on Carol Burnett?
Mr. Tudball?
How do you know his name?
It was Mr. Tudball.
It's like the two of them would be walking so slowly and just kind of puffing up their chest to knock into it. That's what you're getting.
Right.
That's terrible.
Would you go back in time and be kind to a baby Mr. Tudball if you had a chance?
Oh my God, Carol Burnett Show.
Absolutely. A break, some news, more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
The Walking Dead, I'm a big fan. I was late to the party. Bill, you had started watching it, and you said, you got to see it. My son Dylan, 12 years old, says, Mom, this is great. I said, I don't really like zombies. Start watching it. You loved it.
From day one. Yeah.
So I binge-watched, and yes, there are walkers or roamers or biters.
Oh, my. That was pretty good.
That's what they sound like.
That was pretty good.
And yes, there are those types of zombie-like creatures in this, but it's about relationships and, you know, trying to survive the zombie apocalypse, where Rick at one time said, we are the Walking Dead, which is kind of true.
Yep.
But with all the fascination of the zombies and everything, we wanted to learn about a condition where it's actually called the zombie disease. And Dr. Michael Birnbaum is on the line with us, assistant investigator, Center for Psychiatric Neuroscience, the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research. You're a professor. What aren't you, Dr. Birnbaum?
Hi, folks. I'm not a zombie.
Oh, that's good to know.
Very good news for all parties involved. But how could something like this exist? We're trying to figure out what exactly must be going on in somebody's head, doctor, for that to happen, for them to be alive but have the feeling that they are not alive.
So essentially, it is a psychotic symptom, which ultimately means that somebody is somewhat detached from reality, having thoughts that don't necessarily make sense or aren't based in what's actually happening out there. So this is one example of many, many psychotic symptoms that exist in the world. And some of them are particularly unusual, and this is an example of one of the unusual and relatively rare ones, where someone, although they're alive, they believe that they are already in fact dead, or that their organs, for example, are rotting from the inside.
Good God.
It's terrible. Yeah,
very,
it's
very
awful.
Scary stuff.
It's awful. Yeah.
Do they view themselves, you know, how someone who has a weight issue, either anorexia or bulimia, will look in the mirror, and even though they're skinny as they can be, they still see themselves as fat? Is this person looking at their image and thinking, you know, oh, look, my spleen is hanging out and I'm decomposing as we speak?
So anorexia is not a psychotic disorder, but it's you're bringing up a very good point. It's similar in the sense that no matter what, when you tell somebody who's anorexic that they are that they are underweight, they don't see it that way.
Yeah.
And so similarly, people who have psychotic disorders, they have fixed and false beliefs. So no matter what evidence is suggesting the contrary, they will still hold on to a specific idea. And in this case, the idea would be that they're dead.
Do they even make an attempt to communicate, or do they just say, it's pointless, I'm dead, I don't even need to try to communicate with anybody?
So everybody's different, of course, and these experiences are experienced different by every individual who's struggling with them. So it's hard to sort of make a blanket statement like that. And it depends on the illness that it's associated with. It usually doesn't happen on its own, but it's part of a larger disorder. So, for example, people with schizophrenia, they have a number of psychotic symptoms. One of them could be this Cotard delusion, and also people who have very severe forms of major depressive disorder can also believe that they are already dead. So there's no one way that somebody will present, and usually it's in within a constellation of other symptoms.
How many cases have you known about?
Very few. It's very rare. I run a program specifically designed for young people who are in the very beginning stages of psychotic disorders. It's called the Early Treatment Program. And we work with young people between the ages of 15 and 35 who are just sort of starting to develop schizophrenia or other psychotic disorders. So we see all sorts of unusual and scary experiences that people present with. This is something that is incredibly rare. I haven't seen it very much, but I have seen it.
All right. There was an author who was talked about in this story, Esme Wang. She was among the people who experienced this Cotard syndrome firsthand in November of 2013. Wang came to the conclusion that she had been dead for a month. Her belief was bolstered by a fainting incident on a flight home from London to San Francisco. According to Esme Wang, she believed that she actually died during that flight. And this according to The Washington Post. She was completely convinced that she died on the flight. She said she was in the afterlife and hadn't realized it until that moment. That was the beginning of when I was conceived that I was dead. But I wasn't upset about it because I thought that I could go about my business and do things in my life and do my life over and maybe do them better. Mm. So she thought she was going to come back to life. That
right.
really is delusional.
Yeah, it's incredibly scary, and you could imagine that everybody would sort of respond individually to that particular experience. And some people may say that I'm going to keep doing what I need to do despite having this idea, and other people may respond to it and say, "Yeah, I'm already dead. There's no point in living and doing what I need to do."
If somebody has this, Dr. Birnbaum, is the best treatment some sort of therapy, or is there a drug that would help the brain to not have the delusions that it's having, or is it a mixture of those things? What's the treatment like?
So generally, the treatment for anybody who's struggling with a psychotic disorder or a psychotic symptom is two things. One is an antipsychotic medication, and there are a number of those. And then in addition to that, there is very focused cognitive behavioral therapy for psychotic symptoms to help individuals understand what's going on and overcome these ideas and be able to function despite having this incredible obstacle of believing that they're dead, for example.
All right, and I have to share with you this last thing here. This Esme Wang, again, this was November 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Though she was interacting with her husband and their dog, Daphne, Wang believed that they were dead, too, and that they were sharing an afterlife together.
Wow.
That's sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad and scary. And it's not, again, this is relatively rare, but sometimes what you'll see is an individual believing that not only are they dead, but they're already in an afterlife. They're already in heaven, already in hell, and all the players around them are also already dead.
What sort of a success rate are we looking at, Dr. Birnbaum, from people not just who have Cotard syndrome, but similar delusional problems? Is there a fairly decent ratio of getting people back to normal?
Yeah, well, now we know more than ever that the key here is early intervention, right? So the earlier you can capture this illness, the better people do. And now early intervention programs are really popping up all over the states. To catch psychotic disorders when they're at just the very beginning stages, as opposed to waiting till they metastasize and take over. And unfortunately, in the United States, people could be ill with psychotic disorders for many, many years before they finally get the help that they need. And it's a real tragedy and something that we have to work very hard to change.
All right, you mentioned schizophrenia falling under these psychotic disorders. What else is bipolar under that umbrella as well?
So you can have a bipolar disorder with psychotic features. Similarly, you can have a depressive disorder with psychotic features. And you can have schizoaffective disorder, which is essentially both a mood disorder and a psychotic disorder, or schizophreniform. Essentially, these are somewhat semantic differences, but there's a cluster of psychotic disorders where someone would present with psychotic symptoms, one of them being... So, for example, psychotic symptoms are delusions, the mm-hmm. ones that we've been talking about, and they come in a whole host of different shapes and sizes. Paranoid delusions. Sometimes people feel like they're being followed or monitored by the FBI, that their parents, for example, are not their parents and have been replaced by imposters. So you can imagine all these thoughts are very scary. And also another example of a psychotic symptom could be perceptual abnormalities. So as though your brain is playing tricks on you, the things that you use to understand the world, your eyes, your ears, your senses are playing tricks. So you're hearing a voice, for example, when actually nothing is there, or you're seeing something when nothing is there. And when these things come together as a constellation, we sometimes call it schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, depending on what is happening and how long it's been going on for.
Are these problems usually inborn, or are they usually brought upon by like prolonged drug use, or is it a combination of those?
It's a combination. What we know now is that people are born with a genetic vulnerability, meaning that there's something inherent with their biology that makes them at risk of developing a disorder like this. And then a culmination of life events. Sometimes it happens when someone moves away for college. There are certain environmental factors that come into play, too. And the exact algorithm, we don't know. But it's sort of when the perfect storm hits, that's when the disorder unfortunately breaks.
Both my kids have ADHD, and of course it's very common that a parent gets diagnosed after their kids were diagnosed.
Right.
Makes a lot of sense of, you know, why I had to sit in the quiet chair all the time in kindergarten. But we have a psychiatric appointment tomorrow, and the psychiatrist always goes through this list. Do you hear voices? Do you see things that you're not sure if they're there? And that's all to make sure that this psychotic disorder is not present in them, correct?
Correct. That's sort of our standard list of questions when we're going through to assess for depression, for psychotic disorders, and those would be good questions to explore whether or not.
Except my 16-year-old always goofs around and said, "Yeah, I saw this big woolly mammoth in my room other night," and that's just kidding.
That's great, Dr. Right. Birnbaum. We started out by talking about The Walking Dead. Do you see a spike in something like Cotard syndrome? Whenever there's a pop phenomena like Walking Dead, are more people prone to think they might be dead because the show is so popular, or does that not play into it at all?
I don't think so. I don't think it's that folks are that influenced by what's happening in the moment. I mean, I have to say, as the world has changed, psychotic symptoms have changed too. So, now more than ever, people are feeling as though they're being spied on by their iPhone or that there's a chip in their brain. Of course, none of these thoughts would have existed before iPhones or this type of technology existed. So it has something to do with the environment, but I wouldn't say that it's that susceptible to pop culture like watching zombies on the television.
Okay, good.
Well, I do want to tell you that the Apple TV, you can actually say to your TV, you can talk to Siri and say, you know, find me the Blackhawks game that's on tonight. So if Siri can hear you when you want something, Siri can hear you. She is spying
Absolutely.
On you. So,
sure, and there's some truth to there's potentially some truth to some of these ideas. And as a psychiatrist, I think that it's challenging sometimes to differentiate what is right, what is wrong, what is real, and what isn't. And so I don't necessarily have to make that distinction. I think ultimately it boils down to whether or not this is something that is significantly interfering with somebody's life and somebody's happiness and somebody's ability to work and go to school and have friendships. So people can believe anything that they want to believe as long as it's not really getting in the way. And even somebody may have an idea that they're already dead, but if they're still able to go to school, go to work, have friends, family, do what they need to do, then it's not for me to say that that's a wrong idea.
Right. And we just have to talk about mental issues and stop, you know, brushing them under the rug, because then people
Absolutely.
Will get help. Is there a website where people can find out more information about your programs?
So if you Google the early treatment program, it should be the first one that comes up. It's part of the North Shore LIJ Health System, and you'll be able to get more info about what we do with the early treatment program and some of the staff here and some of the research opportunities that are also going on over here.
That's Dr. Michael Birnbaum explaining
Thank you, sir.
Exactly what Cotard syndrome is. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Anytime.
Okay. How about that?
That is freaky. This woman really, it happened on a flight. She fainted and came to and thought the plane crashed.
Yeah.
And she was walking dead.
Yeah.
She really thought that and then went home, communicated with her husband and her dog and thought they had died too. And she was just living in the afterlife.
Isn't that something?
That's scary,
it's
man.
It's so scary. And actually, well, let's take a break. I will tell you about an actor whose work you may be familiar with who has a version of this. So we'll talk about that in just a little bit. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
And Bears fans, wow, I still can't believe they won on Monday Night Football.
Yeah.
Join Chicago Tribune Sports Plus for a sports-only membership that includes award-winning coverage, great perks, and more at chicagotribune.com/sportsplus. With zombies being all the rage, we came across this story where people really think they are zombies. It's called the zombie disease, Cotard syndrome. And we spoke to Dr. Birnbaum, who works with this type of thing. Although it's very, very rare. Someone said this TV show was featured on Hannibal.
Oh, really?
The TV show Hannibal had this, the person on there had this disorder.
Had Cotard syndrome.
Uh-huh.
He mentioned, he was talking about various delusions, and he was throwing out some examples, like if you automatically think that people you know, your family, are not who they say they are. There was an actor for a while on, he started out on SCTV, and then he was on Saturday Night Live, and his name is Tony Rosato. Do you remember him at all? He did, I think, 2 or 3 years on SCTV, and then a couple of years on Saturday Night Live. He's a Canadian actor. The character that took off the most for him was Chef Sebastiani, an Italian chef. Anyway, in recent times, he was under the belief.
Oh, I totally remember.
You see,
him.
You're looking at a picture of him. He was under the belief that his wife and child, and I don't remember if he had a son or a daughter, that they were somehow replaced by space aliens. Space aliens came and changed bodies with his wife and his child and couldn't live with them anymore and is now in a rehabilitation center, has been for a number of years because he had those sort of delusions. It's a sad story. A friend of his, I got to meet a friend of his and I asked about him and he said, oh, the last couple of years have been very rough, and he told me the story and it's just awful. I mean, it's your mind tricking you.
Yeah, Tony Rosato. And he also did the Super Mario, The Adventures of Super Mario Brothers.
The cartoon, I think,
he's
right?
He's an
not the
actor
movie.
And writer known for SCTV, The Adventures of Super Mario Brothers 3.
Oh.
And Night Heat. They have
oh,
won.
Yeah, there was a cop show he was on. I forgot.
Yeah, as soon as I saw him, I do remember yeah. him. And I just wanted to share with you that he once owned a pet monkey named Malden.
All right. I didn't know that about him. I was wondering if he ever owned a monkey, and now I know.
Okay. Well, you like a monkey.
I do enjoy monkeys.
One of only three comedian writers to appear as regulars on both Saturday Night Live and SCTV. Can you name the other two?
Yeah, Martin Short did both,
yep.
and Robin Duke did both.
Ding, ding, right? and double ding.
How about that?
Very good, yeah. I forgot
and almost
about
John
him.
Candy, but he decided at the last minute to not take Saturday Night Live's offer, so there would have been four, but those were the three.
Oh, he would have been
yeah,
so
Yeah,
it was good.
Very funny. All right, a break, and then a lot more show coming your way. We'll talk to Dean Richards in a little bit about this week's movies. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
He knows which movies make you laugh and which ones make you cry. If you love films, then Dean's your guy. So grab yourself some popcorn. He will not talk about hard points. It's Dean.
He is Dean Richards. You can't argue that. He's absolutely 100% Dean Richards. Dean, we started, Wendy and I, at the beginning of the show, were talking about Caitlyn Jenner because Caitlyn Jenner was on the list.
Glamour Magazine Woman of the Year.
Glamour Magazine's yep. Woman of the Year. And they asked...
One of the women of the year.
Yes,
one
there
of the
were women. Many.
There were like six of them, right?
Right.
Yes.
And they
and
asked...
Steve Cochran would argue that she shouldn't have been on there because she hasn't been a woman for a full year.
Actually, that can't. We mentioned the same thing. Only 7 months as a woman, not enough time, maybe.
But she said her. You know, they asked what the toughest part of being a woman for you is, and she says figuring out what to wear, and that's what I have issue if with. If that's the, her biggest problem, boy, she doesn't know what it's like to be a woman.
Right. Well, that's. I think some women in the workplace, you know, wondering about why they're getting paid less money. You know, for one thing. You know, might be something more than which shoes should I wear today.
Right. You would think. Now, you're on your way to an event that Caitlyn Jenner is kind of the, is she the chairperson of? I'm unclear.
She's the Chicago House, which has for decades been providing help to people with HIV and AIDS. I just opened a transgender center helping people who are struggling with that. And they're having a big benefit today at the Chicago Hilton and Towers, and Caitlyn Jenner is their keynote speaker. So it's her first appearance since the ESPY Awards that everybody watched. So I think it's going to be a pretty big event, you know, and there's going to be a lot of attention to what happens today and what she says today. So we'll see. You know, we're going to cover it all. We'll bring it all back to you.
And good for her. Seriously, because there are so many people that are going through this, and to see someone live in the flesh that has gone through it, mm-hmm. I really respect her talking about it. I really do.
You know, it's a controversial subject. I get that. I understand it. I'm you know, I think I'm much better now understanding it than I did before the you know before the Diane Sawyer interview, and you know before learning a little bit more about it. So. You know, I think in that sense, a lot of people have learned how some other people, you know, live their lives. You know, I don't think that hurts anybody to understand a little bit more about others. But the bigger thing for me of why I think it's valuable, there are kids, teenagers, and probably younger all the time, who commit suicide because they're confused about their sexual identity. Because they're rejected and shunned and thrown out by the people in their lives because of their sexual identity. And by Bruce Jenner being public with this, it tells them you're not alone. You're not alone. You know, that there are other people like you. So they don't feel like, you know, that they are the freak. So if it saves a kid from committing suicide, I say God bless him. You know, this is something which is personal, and anything
sure.
that makes a person live their life a little bit happier. Life's too short, and you know, really nobody has any business passing judgment on things that don't affect them.
Yep, so true. A quick congratulations to you, by the way, since we talked to you last. You are the.
Oh, you can do it. You can do it more than quick. We can spend the rest of the segment.
Let's take our time with
should
this.
Should we spend the rest of the segment congratulating me?
Yes, absolutely. Dean is the winner of the 2015. One of the winners of the 2015 Silver Circle Award, which is a very high honor. So, congrats on that.
Yeah, thank you. It's the Chicago TV Academy's sort of Hall of Fame. I'm one of six people. I think six people that will be. I'm really only interested in myself.
Right. Sure.
there are a whole bunch of people who are much more deserving of this than me. And I'm beyond honored that I was chosen for this. So
well deserved.
It's pretty nice. I was pretty surprised when they told me.
Well, you deserve it.
You're the first person, Dean, I believe, to win both the Silver Circle Award and the Cy Young Award. So congrats on that.
That's fantastic. You've been working on that. You know, you get practice, kid. That's all you can say.
It's all you can do. All right, there's a bunch of movies. This is a very big week for movies. Before I get to the list of what's coming out this weekend, we had quite a string of fall films that fell flat. None of the movies did at the box office what they expected them to until last week when the new Bond movie Spectre and the Peanuts movie opened. Both of them did pretty well. Why did we have that down period where nobody was going to see movies for a while? It looked like some good titles, but people weren't going out to the theater.
I think people were just not turned on, engaged by some of the titles, some of the content that have come out. The Sandra Bullock movie about political handling, huge bomb. The Bradley Cooper movie, huge bomb. You know, these are Sandra Bullock's an Oscar winner.
Mm-hmm.
Bradley Cooper is a multi-Oscar nominee. You know, you would think that their films would have done well. Michael Fassbender's version of the Steve Jobs movie was such a bomb that the studio has pulled it out of theaters. That's how poorly that one was doing. At least the other ones are. You can still find them someplace if you want to.
Boy, that's bad if they pull it out.
Yeah, they never do that. I mean, they leave it in to just see whatever kind of money it can make. But Gem and the Holograms.
Yeah.
The kids movie also pulled out.
Right.
Also a huge bomb, and this was based on a really popular source material. So it's been a really interesting fall for some movies that have not caught the public's attention. Matt Damon's The Martian, at the hands mostly of Matt Damon's The Martian, it was number one for like 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no movie that could move it until James Bond came along. The Peanuts movie did fairly well up against it, but it's been pretty interesting. And I'm not so sure that, there's going to be a massive change this week, really. I think probably James Bond will be number one again this week, because while we have a lot of movies opening up, almost all of them are in limited release. At least half of the movies that I'm going to tell you about today are just in a handful of theaters. One of the movies is in one theater in the Chicago area. One of them's in three theaters in Chicago. So, I mean, these are films that they're releasing because they want them to be eligible for the Academy Awards. They have to be released before the end of the year. And they're trying to, get out there and release before the real glut happens around Thanksgiving and Christmas time. So while there are some really good movies that are opening this weekend, and one really horrible movie from two people who you would never expect it from,
mm-hmm.
There's... I don't think you're going to see a seismic change in the box office numbers this coming week.
Dean Richards is our guest. He'll tell you about those movies that you might want to seek out, and then the movie that is horrible from two people you wouldn't expect would put out a horrible movie. All that's coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Dean Richards is here. Yes, the Silver Circle Award winning Dean Richards. Absolutely right.
You told me Silver Surfer.
Stop. I did say Silver Surfer.
Stop.
Well, see, I can't stop, Dean.
Stop.
I can't stop.
Honestly, when they called me, at first I thought they had won. I don't know if you remember from WKRP in Cincinnati, the Silver Sow Award.
Yes, yes.
I was tremendously honored when I thought that I won an agriculture broadcasting award, since I'm not an agriculture broadcaster.
Right.
I thought, this is fantastic that someone's made a terrible mistake, but I don't care.
No, it's an award. An award is an award.
It turns out it's this Silver Circle with the Chicago TV Academy. So it's amazing.
Are you going to put it in your study with all the other awards?
Yes, yes, I am going to put away all my other awards.
Yes, it's in my study, says Dean. Dean,
I've got it with my Boy Scout merit badges are there.
Excellent.
I think I've got a tennis trophy.
Oh,
for high school that might be there.
That's you great. Were a Boy Scout. Did you make it to Eagle Scout?
I did not because I was terrified. I almost drowned when I was a kid.
Oh, no.
I was terrified to swim. I didn't learn how to swim until I was in college. So I got all my merit badges for Eagle Scout except the water swimming and life saving. So
go
I don't
get
know
it
if I
now.
Can go back and make those up now.
You can.
You can make them up.
Can I really?
Yeah.
Once an Eagle Scout, always an Eagle Scout.
Sure.
How great would that be if I got in the Silver Circle and made Eagle Scout in the same week?
Just to see you in the outfit would be just fantastic.
Oh, put it. You got to wear it.
Uniform. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it still fits from when
I was
12.
Oh, that would be fantastic. That would be great. All right, you teased us. You said that there's a movie coming out that's horrible from two people that you wouldn't expect. I think I know what it is, but tell everybody. What are we talking about?
You get a movie with Brad Pitt and an Angelina Jolie in it, and you got to think that it's, a guaranteed home run. They had that movie a few years ago, Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yeah.
Where they met, fell in love. He destroyed Jennifer Aniston's life.
Yeah.
That
I'll never forgive him for that, by the way.
A lot of people are right with you at that. But anyway, that was a great movie. They're both great actors.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's a pretty good director. And this new movie that they have coming out, fortunately, it's only in like three theaters. So, not too many people are going to be subjected to it. It's called By the Sea. It's like a sort of a moody European, overly artsy, overly esoteric story about a married couple going through a difficult time in their marriage and trying to sort it out. But only the storytelling in the most obtuse, complex way possible. It's a beautiful film. It's beautifully shot. But the film could not be more confusing and boring and honestly sort of worthless.
Isn't
really.
That sad? I wonder what happened there.
I think it's part of the problem is really bad writing.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. Unfortunately, Angelina Jolie wrote and directed the film as well.
No.
So we're going to have to put a lot of the blame squarely at her feet with this. I'm saying don't go to see it. I'm giving this one Dean's List D-, giving it a little bit of credit because it is, I have to say, it is a beautifully shot film.
I noticed, Dean, in the previews for it, I saw a preview for it last night, and she is billing herself in this movie anyway as Angelina Jolie Pitt. Is there a reason for
the name change? Well, she got married.
Oh, she did.
She's officially, they're official now.
All right.
So, she's using her married name. I'll tell you what is kind of interesting that I haven't really noticed in any other reviews. There are a couple of scenes in which Angelina Jolie is in a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
And you see her like sort of from the waist up in the bathtub,
mm-hmm.
the naked.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of interesting. I don't know if this was before her double mastectomy. I don't know if they used some sort of prosthetic, but it didn't. I don't really know what it looks like after a mastectomy because I know there's extensive cosmetic surgery that can also take place with it. But it didn't look. It didn't look like any surgery had been done.
Oh.
It just looked like a woman with no top on.
Right.
Well, she got implants, I would imagine, after the double mastectomy.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't know how surgically, if there's scarring.
It's underneath the bulbous part of the breast, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So
well,
you wouldn't
would
see it.
That. Yeah, that would explain that. But, it was like, she's extremely thin in the movie. It's part of the plot line. She's not a well woman in the movie. She's very thin and frail.
Hmm.
So knowing her health history, was a little bit distracting to me given her physical appearance in this movie. But honestly, you'll be about half an hour into this movie, you're going to pass out from boredom.
It's
anyway.
That bad.
Nothing else is going to matter.
Right.
So go for the boobs and then cut out.
Beautifully shot. It's beautifully shot. Cinematography, absolutely beautiful. Watch the boobs, and then sneak next door and go watch The Martian.
All right.
So Matt instead, Damon also has very nice boobs.
Oh, he does. All right. Well, that's good news. So instead of by the C, you're saying by the D minus. That's what you're saying?
By the D. Wow.
By the D cup.
I thought of that.
Thank you. I'm in constant contact with Gene Shalit. He's always giving me movie titles and
Thank
ideas.
Thank you.
What about Trumbo?
Trumbo, I loved. Trumbo, I absolutely loved. It's Bryan Cranston. It's Helen Mirren. A fantastic cast of colorful supporting performances from Louis C.K., from John Goodman, who I love in any movie that he's in. He's just as fantastic as ever. Louis C.K. is also fantastic. I mean, good on the list. There's just one great character actor after another in this movie that is a true story about a Hollywood screenwriter named Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the 10 Hollywood personalities in the late 40s, blacklisted by the Congressional Committee, the Joseph McCarthy's Red Scare Committee, you know, trying to find communists in Hollywood, who were blacklisted, their lives, their careers destroyed. This is the story of Dalton Trumbo, who is a very famous screenwriter who continued to work and continued to write under other people's names before he was vindicated many years later. It's just a very interesting story and such rich, amazing, wonderful performances, funny and quirky, and it's history. It really happened. You know, this kind of witch hunting that actually went on by the government, you know, on Americans that happened. Helen Mirren plays the famous gossip columnist Hedda Hopper, who, you know, she was the legendary, you know, gossip columnist.
She could make you or break you.
She could make you or break you and really misused her column for character assassination, for furthering her own political views. She went after Dalton Trumbo and other people that she suspected might be communist and took them down in her column. She's fantastic.
She's beautiful.
The film looks good. She is so great. And when do you see her? You know, Hedda Hopper was kind of famous for her outlandish outfits and her big hats.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was a force of nature in real life. And what they do to Helen Mirren in this movie to personify that is just great. This is my favorite movie of the week by far.
Oh, excellent. What is your Dean's List rating for Trumbo?
Dean's List A on this one. I gave this one a Dean's List A. It's pretty great.
I'm anxious to see it. All right, so Avoid by the Sea. Go see Trumbo. Dean, thanks again for being here, and congrats on that Silver Surfer Award. We're very, very proud of you.
Hang 10.
Hang 10, says Dean Richards.
Congrats,
thanks, Dean.
Thank you.
It's the Silver Circle Award. We'll be back after this. We'll find out what Steve has on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Kim, thanks so much. Hi, welcome to part two of our show. It's me, Bill Left. It's her, Wendy Snyder. You can jump in at any point during the show, 312-981-7200. That's a call line and a text line.
Very good. Boy, you got all that out right away.
A lot of information.
It's kind of interesting to have a little break in the middle of the show.
Uh-huh.
It has trained me now that whenever I do something, I always need a little break. Perhaps I'm making dinner. I should take a little break.
Right.
And then go back to making dinner.
And does Steve Bertrand come to your home and just for an hour talk to business people for 60 minutes?
It's pretty awesome.
Makes a difference.
Sometimes Dr. J comes with them.
Dr. John Najarian just comes over. How about that?
That's pretty fun.
I've had Terry Savage in my home. I don't know how she gets in. I look over and there she is. So we're kind to her. She's a nice lady.
Very much so. She's a savage, though, I hear. That's how she gets in.
That's what they're saying.
So a lot of people say, and I don't know if they're asking you this, but they're certainly asking me, what do you guys do during your break? Mm-hmm. And they really keep asking.
Mm-hmm.
Even people here go, so what do you do?
Right.
So
not just about the break. They just say, what do you do? And I'll say, what do you mean, what do? We have a show. Oh, all right.
Yeah, but I think that's why my ID pass stopped working, if you want to know the truth.
Could be.
So we go upstairs and we record a magical promo with Chris Duffy, the production whiz, and that, of course, will be running after we get off the air until we come back tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes about 30 seconds.
Yeah, if that, right?
Then we chat, and today we had lunch. Zoom Pizza Factory dropped off a bunch of interestingly good pizzas.
Peculiar flavors that you're not used to having on pizza. Some of them more standard, but some of them were a little more unusual. We tried those. Those were very good.
Artisan type things.
Artisan type pizzas, right.
Like figs. Sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. Really good crust. I had the pesto pizza with asparagus, artichokes, and pepperoni. It was really good.
Yeah.
It was very rich, though,
mm-hmm.
which is awesome because otherwise I would have eaten about 20 pieces.
Well, you're very rich, so it all makes sense.
I'm a richy rich.
Yep.
And Zoom Pizza Factory, you can go to zoompizzafactory.com. They are having a pizza party, and you can enter to win a chance to win free pizza for a year. This is all going on Saturday, November 14th, 11:30 to 10:30, 2156 North Clybourne. They have prizes to give away. Go to zoompizzafactory.com. And Bill, we have a little something to share with our listening audience right
now. Yeah, you came up with this a while ago. You thought if we on the show are getting free food, it's not fair unless listeners also get free food. So we have managed a way to make some lucky listeners also experience Zoom pizza.
Yes, but then they have to come in and take a nap with us, too, which we also try to do during the
break. Right, right.
312-981-7200. If you would like a $50 gift certificate to Zoom Pizza Factory, 2156 North Clybourne, go to zoompizzafactory.com or call right now. Let's take the 5th and 10th caller, Kevin. 5th and 10th caller, 312-981-7200. You will each get a $50 gift certificate to Zoom Pizza Factory.
They sent over one $50 gift card, but we've got a copying machine upstairs, so we just copied it and made a second one. So now we have two prizes to give away.
A, don't ever say that again. Two, the second person's going to be kind of disappointed. Check the barcode, people.
Right, make sure the barcode is intact, please, before you do anything.
Don't post it on social media because someone will steal the barcode for your Zoom Pizza Factory gift card.
That's what's happened to society, Wendy.
Do you buy things? Have you ever bought a ticket somewhere outside a baseball park or a football game or a hockey game? When you go to the game, do you ever go there without a ticket hoping to buy one? I have never done that
in my life.
I've
never done that, no. No, I want to know in advance.
Yeah, because what if you don't get one, or what if you don't want to spend what they're
right.
asking?
I know.
But I think we're the minority here. I think a lot of people do go hoping to get
everyone
tickets.
Everyone does, yeah.
That's scary to me. All right, Jeremy's on the road, and he was caller number 5, and he is going to get a Zoom Pizza Factory $50 gift card, and Pat in Crystal Lake, who is not on the road.
Right.
I don't
Just
know.
In the privacy of Pat's own home.
Right.
Right. So congrats to both of you, Jeremy and Pat. You can go to Zoom Pizza together or separately. We'll leave that up to you.
Can I talk about other restaurant news?
Yeah, what's up?
There was talk before about restaurants going not topless, tipless.
Tipless, not topless. And that means what exactly?
They're going to drop the whole tipping. They're going to be paying their employees, their wait staff, more money.
Uh-huh.
Because now I've never been a waiter. Have you?
For a day. I was for one day.
Why one day, Bill?
When I started dating Terry, because she's an actress, if you're an actress, many times you also wait tables somewhere, and that was her job. And there was a time that I dropped her off at work, and they were in a panic because several members of their wait staff were not available that night. So the owner said to me, hey, is there any chance you could wait tables tonight? And I said, I'll be the worst waiter you've ever had. And she said, it doesn't matter. We just need a waiter. So
They just hired you off the street like that?
Well, yeah. I'd been in there a bunch of times.
As a waiter.
Never as a waiter and never again as a waiter.
You
as
didn't
it turned
like
out.
It?
I just wasn't really good at it. Like when they would ask my opinion, like they'd go, is this good? No, I would not get that. If I were you, I would not order that.
Worst waiter ever.
That was me. But I got good. I mean, surprisingly, because I thought I'm going to walk. I'm going to get 50 cents or a dollar if I'm lucky. It was pretty lucrative, actually.
They probably liked your honesty.
Yeah, maybe.
Didn't they feel awkward when you sat at the table and chatted them up when their food arrived?
I was told that was wrong.
Well, my job's done. I've delivered your plate, so I'm going to sit here and chat for a bit.
I saw him do it at Ed the Bevix. I thought you do that at all restaurants.
Well, I would be a good waitress because I really have a food obsession, and I would like to present somebody with a beautiful plate.
Right.
That would make me happy. But have you ever been to a Joe's Crab Shack?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to become the first major chain to drop tipping. They're going to start paying workers a living wage. The seafood chain will experiment with dropping tipped wages in 18 of its stores. This according to the head of its parent company. And here's what they said. Servers, hosts, bartenders are paid now higher fixed hourly wages.
Yeah.
Did I say rages?
You said rages, but I meant wages.
It's expected to result in an improved team atmosphere, a significant reduction in turnover, and greater financial security for the employees. They were once paid $2 an hour plus tips.
Yeah.
$2 an hour?
Yep.
What if no one came in the restaurant that day?
That's the risk of being a waiter or waitress. I know, it sounds it's terrible. It is terrible.
I got to tell you, I'm really shocked here.
At the low price that they're making?
I know they get to keep tips, but still $2 an hour?
Yeah, and I've heard from people, friends of mine who have waited tables, that there were nights where you would lose money because you get taxed on what the perceived tip is. And then if you don't make the perceived tip and you're only coming away with a couple of bucks an hour, there were nights that they would lose money. So you go, I just put in 6 hours and I lost $11. How'd that happen?
Listen, I am a pretty decent tipper.
Yeah.
Most of the time because my name's on the credit card and I don't want somebody, you know, calling the radio station and saying, do you know Wendy Snyder is the biggest cheapskate?
Right.
She's much like no tippin' pippin.
Well, Kevin gets those calls, but he filters them. We don't get them on the air.
No, you don't, because I am very careful. If it's Jim's credit card, I don't care what he tips.
Right.
But if it's my name on it, but I'm telling you, I didn't realize they made $2 an hour plus tips.
Well,
at Joe's.
That one, right.
Joe's Crab Shack.
Right.
They'll now be paid at least $12 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And experienced staff members are going to make even more.
Mm-hmm.
And they get tips. Oh, no, there's no tips.
There is no tips.
But
so that's it. That's the cutoff. That's why I think
it's a huge difference, though.
It's a difference, but it could work for you or against you. For instance, here's what I think. If I was a waiter or a waitress, I would think to myself, I bet I don't make as much money because the impetus to do really, really good, to be a good server, might go away a little bit because you go, I'm making $12 an hour, whether I'm good or not good. Why go that extra mile?
Because people are still going to tip.
Do you think so? Even with this in place, you think they would?
I mean, come on. They always tell you at the all-inclusive resorts, no tipping allowed.
Right.
You don't tip somebody?
I do, but
see?
I think most people don't. I really don't think.
We're so used to tipping.
Yeah. But the draw on this is for people who go, I'm sick of tipping people. I'm not going to do it anymore. Oh, look, there's a restaurant that doesn't accept tips. That's where I'm going. That's what they're hoping for, right?
Well, someone who is a wait person or knows of it says that's ridiculous. In an hour, you can wait up to 7 or 8 different tables, and $12 an hour in the service industry is not enough to work for a large corporation. That's ridiculous.
They're going to lose money on
okay,
this.
Okay, so the wait staff doesn't like this idea.
I wouldn't think so. And I don't know why the restaurant would like the idea either, because they're responsible for the $12. If they're only paying $2 an hour now, all of a sudden they're responsible for $12 an hour. You multiply that by how many wait staff are on the floor. They're losing money. The waiter or waitress is losing money. The only people who are making out on this really are the customers.
I don't like it.
It's not. See? It sounds good. Like when you first hear it, you go, oh, that's going to be good. I don't think it is good.
Why can't they up them to $5 an hour and
still have tips?
Yeah.
That would be better.
$2 an hour at Joe's Crab Shack. But I know that's not everywhere.
It is different in different restaurants. It is.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a break. And if you've waited tables more than one day like Bill did, I never did.
Just the one night. That was it. And I've got my reunion coming up, so I'm going to go back. I miss a lot of the people I worked with that night. 312-981-7200. Give us a call or a text. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Learn how real Chicagoans live, the day-to-day struggles and successes with health, fitness, and food. Watch Living Healthy Chicago. That's Sundays at 11:30 a.m. on WGN-TV.
Joe's Crab Shack becomes first major chain to drop tipping. This move follows famed New York restaurateur Danny Meyer's announcement last month that all of his eateries were getting rid of tipping. Celebrity chef Tom Colicchio is also experimenting with the policy. And this particular place, Joe's Crab Shack, the seafood chain was experimenting with this for a little bit. Employees who were once paid around $2 an hour plus tips will now be paid at least $12 an hour. Experienced staff stand to make even more than that, but no tips.
But realistically, a restaurant is going to pass that savings, quote unquote, on to you. They're going to charge more for their food because they're out the money. If they're saying we're going to take it upon ourselves to make this up to the staff, we're going to pay them. they're not going to take a hit on this. They're going to charge more for their food. That's the only way they can make it up.
So you're saying, in a way, it's kind of a lose-lose for everyone, except the restaurant owner.
I think somewhere in the head of the customer, they're like, I'm going to save money. I don't have to drop a tip anymore. I'm going to make money on this. But I don't think so.
Yeah, I agree with you. Hey, Mike, what do you think about this? I think people are still going to tip.
No, I don't think they will tip. They figure, okay, this guy's making $12 an hour. They're going to say, screw him. He's already making a pretty good buck. And the second part is this, you know, the thing of it is that, like Bill said, they're just going to jack up the prices of all the products. They're going to jack up the price on the food, and especially on the booze, because that's where the restaurant makes their money, is on
right.
the booze.
Yep,
so that's true.
So when some people are sitting there drinking a few beers, you know, you get the average bunch of guys on a Friday night sitting in the bar, you know, in the bar area drinking, you know, figure, okay, $4 or $5 for a beer. The bartender or the server comes by, hey, thanks a lot, nice job, drops like $10 for, you know, taking care of them. But they figure, okay, this guy's getting $12 now. He says, screw the tip.
Is there going to be a sign when you walk in the restaurant that says no tipping allowed? How are you going to know if this is a restaurant that takes tips or doesn't?
Well, hopefully they post it.
All right.
A big picture of Scottie Pippen on the front door of the restaurant, just to remind you that no tipping is allowed.
You know, don't you kind of feel bad busting him every single time?
He's the patron saint of poor tipping. He really is.
Maybe he forgot that night. It was one
it's
time
possible.
It was written in the paper, and then.
Right.
That's what he knows by. All right. I think the producer misread the story. The pay was increased by $2 an hour at Joe's Crab Shack, not according to the Huffington Post.
They said that the base salary was $2 an hour plus the tips.
And now they'll be paid at least $12 an
right,
hour.
Right.
All right. There was something I wanted to read here. I'm a server. I make $4.95 per hour. I work day shifts, 10 to 3. It's a family-run business, so I don't always claim my tips. So if you aren't making tips and just making hourly as a server, it will really mess up your take-home. Love you guys.
It would have to. It would definitely have to. But I think the biggest point, and it's not in the story, but I tried to make it earlier, is if you're a waiter or a waitress, I think the drive to do a really good job goes down the hill a little bit because you know you're going to make the $12 an hour no matter what happens. So why would a lot of people go, I'm going to try to work harder and faster and make sure everything's right? Because you go, I get the same amount of money.
773 says, hey, Bill, the customers are not coming ahead or not coming out ahead because Wendy did not tell you that the shack also raised the food prices.
Well, that's what I would guess.
I wasn't holding it back. It wasn't in the store.
Why didn't you tell me that part? That's the most important part.
It was a ruse.
But that's what I mean. Anytime something like this happens in business, they pass that savings, not really savings, they pass that on to you, the customer. That's just how it is.
Do you tip to tip or tip based on service?
Do I? I do kind of both.
Me too.
Don't you?
I tip 20% every time, and I do it off the total. I have friends that say to me, oh, no, it's 20% of the pre-tax.
Right.
No, it isn't. I mean, yes, it could be, but I mean,
it's
really?
The difference of a couple of dollars
right.
here and there.
And if it's great service.
Right. Then you don't mind doing it. We're the same way. Terry, because she waited tables for years, she always says if something goes wrong, it's rarely the waiter or waitress's fault. It's usually a problem in the kitchen. So there have been a couple times where we've had really poor service, and the waiter or waitress still gets the 20% tip. The bigger question, though, is people always say you're not supposed to tip on the alcohol bill because it's the same amount of effort. Say you got a $500 bottle of champagne. It's the same amount of effort to bring that bottle and uncork it as it is an $8 bottle of champagne.
I never heard that till you told me that.
That's been a restaurant point of contention for decades is why am I if somehow you're rich enough to buy expensive alcohol, why would you pay an extra premium for that?
Because it's better than the crappy alcohol.
For the alcohol itself, but I'm saying for the waiter to bring over the four glasses of wine that costs $100 as opposed to the four glasses of wine that cost $8
each.
Yeah,
but what if you order a $75 lobster tail and your date orders a hamburger?
You're paying on that too. Steve, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, if I do that, have a lobster tail, my date orders a hamburger, I'm going to ask her out again.
Right. And your wife will get just as mad, won't
right,
she?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's not fair. I have never taken off for, you know, because first of all, I shouldn't drink that much. If the bar bill's more than the food bill,
right,
and I got to pay for it.
Here's something else we do that I would hope that other people are doing this. I hope we're not the only ones. there's an Italian restaurant near us that we eat at about every month, like say every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks. We get a coupon from them in our email about once a month. It's the October coupon. It's the November coupon. So that's 15% off the meal. And at the risk of sounding like my own grandparents, we rarely use coupons. But in this, we we're going to go there. It's easy.
And you're giving them repeat business. Right. So that's why they're doing the coupon.
Right. When we tip, we don't take that 15% off into account. We tip on what the bill would have been.
Well, that's what you're supposed to do.
That's what we're supposed to. I hope other people do the same thing, because it's not the waiter or waitress's fault that we have a coupon. I do sound like my own grandparents at this point.
There's kids
in the yard. I'm going to yell at them. Get off our yard.
That's what kills me, when I hear myself say something to the kids, and then I'm like, oh, my God,
yeah.
I've turned into my mother.
Right. Can I go? Because Matlack is about to start, and I want to see that.
All right. Well, we all have to go. Thanks for your calls. We couldn't get to all of them. But, yeah, at this point, Joe's Crab Shack becomes the first major chain to drop tipping. I'm anxious to see what happens, and they would have to place a sign out there saying, you know, this is a tip-free zone
or something like that. Right.
Tip cows, not people.
That's what they'll use. That's what they will use, yes. All right, a break, and then some news from Steve, and then more show coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks so much. It's Bill F. and it's Wendy Snyder. Jump in, 312-981-7200 if you like. David Kidwell joins us right now. David is the fine investigative. What's wrong?
Kevin is saying something in my ear. David, we will give you a proper introduction, but Kevin's like, do you get it? With the song.
I don't get it. What is it?
Don't Stop Till You Get Enough.
Oh, you're good.
That's
you're very,
lame.
Very talented. David Kidwell is an investigative political reporter who's now investigating why we played that intro music for him. Works over at the Tribune and has just written a great article about the red light cameras and a domino effect that I don't think they were anticipating when they first put these red light cameras into effect. Thanks very much for being here, David. How are you?
Good to be here.
Let's talk about this. The original intent of the red light cameras is fairly obvious, but for people who don't know, they wanted to catch speeders.
Were you talking about red light cameras or speeding cameras?
Well, the speeding cameras initially, but let's go to both.
Well, they started with the red light cameras, and they're stated purpose for the red light cameras was to stop people from running red lights.
Yeah.
That's been a point of contention since they first installed them.
Yeah.
First installed the first one back in 2003.
Yeah. It's been that long?
Oh, yeah. It's been a long time they've had red light cameras. Speed cameras are newer. The speed cameras belong to the current mayor. The red light cameras came in under Daley.
Yeah.
But it's been a point of contention for a long time. The critics of the program have, since it first installed, said it was more about money than stopping people from running red lights.
And how could a politician deny that? I mean, it's fairly obvious that that's what it is. It's a source of revenue.
Is it making it safer? Is it making intersections safer? Because that's fine then.
Right. Well, so this program, the red light camera program, has made more than $600 million for the city.
And we're still in debt.
And to this day, I don't believe they have spent any of that money studying the safety benefits of it. So last year, the Tribune decided to do that on its own, and we went out and did the first scientific study of is it making things safer? And what we essentially found was they may be making things safer at a number of locations, but at almost 40% of them, there is no benefit from the cameras. And in addition to that, they're increasing the amount of people who slam on their brakes and are involved in the more minor rear-end crashes.
Because you don't want to be caught on camera, so you're timing it out in your head, and you go, I better stop here, and that causes a problem.
And again, what we found was that's due to a lot of factors, and that is the fact that the city of Chicago has the shortest yellow lights of any major city in the city. So you add that to the fact that you're throwing up a red light camera, and people the people can't go through at the end of a yellow light anymore. So they, instead of doing that, they tend to slam on the brakes more. And we found a 22% increase where these red light cameras are in rear end crashes.
But can I just say a rear end crash is not it's usually not fatal.
Correct. And we did find at the same time a 15% reduction in the more serious T-bone crashes at the cameras. However, when you break it down camera by camera, there are at nearly half the cameras, there is no benefit. That 15% goes away because there weren't enough T-bone accidents to begin with. And so what that leads us to is, how did you choose where to put the cameras in the first place? And that's when the corruption comes in.
Mm-hmm.
This whole story started for me because we uncovered the fact that the entire program, the red light camera program, is built on a bribery scheme. There have already been two people who have pled guilty to it. So the person who was in charge of placing these red light cameras has been charged in a federal indictment with taking up the $1,500 per camera. Based and so this whole camera grew to almost 400. This whole system grew to almost 400 cameras, with the guy putting them in place, taking cash payment.
One guy
at City Hall who's been charged. The CEO of the company, the Redflex Traffic System, has already pled guilty to that bribery scheme. He's set to stand trial in January. So
wait, hold on a second. Yeah. So who pays that guy? How does he make that $1,500 per camera? Who's paying him?
So
you'll get to that.
Redflex Traffic Systems, the company that won that contract as part of this alleged conspiracy, and they what they did was they hired a friend of his as a consultant to the company, paid the consultant, and the consultant then in turn. And in addition to the $1,500 per camera, he was also getting 17 trips to the World Series, the Super Bowls, golf outings, cars, condominiums. The guy, it's alleged to be a $2 million bribery.
David, this is not the way Chicago operates. This is foreign to all of us to hear a story like this.
Right. Well, you know, what's disconcerting is that the city of Chicago to this day cannot come up with the reasons why the cameras are where they are. And they have sued the company, because this whole program was built on a bribery scheme. And yet the cameras are still there.
But they are put up willy-nilly, because there are some intersections that I will come to, and I don't even really know how that works. If I come to a complete stop when the light is red, if I turn right on red, aren't I going to get a picture of my license plate? Because I went through a red light.
Yeah, you have to hit, the car has to rock, they say. I mean, you have to hit the brakes, and you have to feel the car stop. You can't roll. That's the issue with the red light cameras.
And I've also heard stories from more than one friend of mine who tell me that they're making a left-hand turn and they're out in the middle of the intersection waiting for the turn.
That happened to me this morning, and I swear I'm going to get a red light camera.
So you know what I mean is car, oncoming traffic is coming. You can't make that left-hand turn until the light kind of turns to red.
You're out a little bit.
Right.
But you're still crossing over that line as the light turned red. So I'm expecting my red light camera ticket any day.
If the front of your car, this is the rules say, I'm not saying this is the way it's working, but the rules say if the front of your car has passed over the line when the light changes from yellow to red, you're good.
Oh.
So you should always check your video. Always go. I recommend to people, always go online. Always check the video. Always check the photographic evidence, because most people, I don't think, do. They just write the check, and that's a mistake.
Especially, so you get a ticket, and you can go online and look that particular ticket number up?
Yes, you take your tag number on the car, which is on the ticket, and the ticket number, and you plug it into the database, and you can see your violation. And like I said, most people don't do that. They just write the check. But especially in this program, they should be watching, because part of the investigation is we looked at literally thousands and thousands of these, and we plotted all of the tickets that have ever been issued by this program over on a kind of an EKG, where we could see how a camera behaved day to day to day to day to day.
Yeah.
And we found these outrageous spikes. They would change what they were enforcing from one day to the next. They would not be enforcing right turns on red one day, and then all of a sudden all of them are being enforced, and then they go back. And all the experts are saying that's not fair. That's just a trap, that they're changing, because these things are supposed to change people's behavior over time. And if they change what you're enforcing, that's not the purpose of the program. That's a way to make money.
I have a friend of mine who actually got he's a retired cop. And he got a ticket and went online to check it. It wasn't his car. It wasn't his plate. Does that happen frequently?
It does. It does. They have private the city of Chicago has private vendors who, number one, review the ticket. And then once there's been a finding that maybe this is a violation, then they forward it to another private vendor who goes to the Secretary of State, gives the tag number to the Secretary of State, and then, right, and then they gather the registration data. But, you know, if the ownership of the car changes, if the tag is stolen, there's all kinds of reasons why right. people should appeal these tickets.
Right. If they've been so lucrative, and they have been, what was the number that you threw
out? More than $600
million. $600 million. Mm-hmm. Why then are there not cameras, and I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but why aren't they at every intersection in the city?
Well, it's a very, very unpopular
program. Sure.
People don't like it, and it became a campaign issue for the mayor. During the campaign, he shut down a number of cameras because of this. Particularly the black aldermen don't like it because it disproportionately affects their community.
Does it? Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're poor. The people in those who live in, I mean, the census tracts.
They can't afford to pay the ticket.
Yeah, they can't afford. You know, and then they're late, and then they get their fine doubled, and then they get another one, and it doubles again and triples, and then their car's booted, and then they lose their job. These stories, you know.
But aren't there amnesty periods? I think we're either in one now or about to go into one where late charges don't apply. Doesn't that fall to these cameras as well?
I think
late charges
don't apply.
Plan.
All right. Yeah, you can go to the city and mitigate your late fees, but they're never going to erase them. I just saw on the news
a day or two ago that there's some amnesty period coming up between now and the end of the year for parking and speeding tickets, but I don't know if these camera tickets are part of that.
Right, I don't know that applies to red light cameras.
Okay. All right.
No,
right.
This is a moving violation.
Moving
not speeding. We have to take a quick break, and people have some questions for you. David Kidwell, investigative political reporter for the Chicago Tribune, right here in the building. 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. 720 WGN.
You sing a song while sitting at a red light.
That's what you're supposed to do, is sit at a red light. Don't go through it.
That's what they're saying, yeah. Yeah. David Kidwell's here, investigative political reporter for your Chicago Tribune, telling us some ugly, ugly stories about the cameras set up at intersections. Boy, the city's making out like bandits.
Yeah, it is the largest red light camera program in the country.
Is it?
By far, more than double.
Who started it? What city started it, and where did we get it from?
Where did red lights come from?
Yeah.
It's a phenomenon that began in the late 90s, just because the technology got to that point, and then there was this fight among several companies that have now grown to these juggernauts, and but they started in smaller communities and have grown. The company that had the contract here first, it was an Australian company, and that's where they started, and moved here, and they were very small when they got the Chicago contract, and the Chicago contract for more than a decade was touted as one of the best run programs in the world, and it helped propel them to become the dominant force. And now, I mean, their stock was trading at $4 a share at one point, and now it's, last time I checked, it was at 17 cents.
Oh boy.
So they're in big trouble.
Yeah,
now.
It sounds.
They're
wow.
in being under investigation in 13 other states for the
really?
Same kind of behavior. Yeah.
All right. Well, we have some listeners who want to get in on this conversation.
Okay.
312-981-7200. Chris, this is David Kidwell, Tribune reporter, and we're talking red light cameras.
I just wanted to let you know that I'm one of the people who did fight the ticket, and I won. I don't live in the city. The camera was at the corner of Rand Road and Golf Road. I believe it's just Blaine's there. And I was surprised to get the ticket because I knew I had come to a stop before I proceeded, and I knew that there was no other traffic around me. So when I did get it, I was able to protest it. I did write a letter to them, and I told them that I watched the video several times. The car obviously rocked forward and came to a stop, and there were no other cars crossing my path, and I said that I knew that I had been in the right, and it took a while. I heard back from them, and they said that I won the case.
Good for you. And
that's
how did
great.
You know to check online? Because I wouldn't have known to do that until David just told me.
I think when the letter came in with the ticket that there was a line there that said that you can watch the video online. And being the way I am, I thought, I'm going to watch it because this can't be possible, because I know I always stop at a red light before I proceed. And it's just something that I do. I'm always really careful about it. So I watched it, and I asked my husband to watch it. I asked my son to watch it. And we sat there and we all said, okay, you did stop. So go ahead, you know, send in your letter. And I did. And actually, I was kind of surprised that I won, but I was very glad that I did it.
Well, good.
So I think people should check.
Thank you so much. That's a story told that has a happy ending, because if you fight it and you're right, you may get out of it. Most people don't fight it. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, it's very, very, very rare.
Rare to win, right?
Well, it's very rare to even appeal. Only about 1% of people appeal red light tickets. Of that, only about 1% of those win.
That's it.
So it's very, very difficult. And what's interesting about the fact that so few people appeal is, I think, has a lot to do with the price point. In California, for instance, the tickets were like $400.
Oh, my God.
A lot more people appealed.
Yeah,
so they've priced these tickets at just enough where people think, well, I could take half a day off work and go down and listen to a hearing officer, or I could just pay the $100. And so that's what most people do. Most people don't even bother to go look at the
evidence. Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah.
All right. I think we have time for one more. Susan, this is David Kidwell.
Yes. I've been driving since 1967. And I drove all over Chicago, Illinois. I drove all over the state of Illinois. And I think the red light camera crap is crap. it's a racket. A racket because you have to turn left on the red because all the other traffic is going through. And then you have to turn left on the red. Now, in Streeter, which is a small town south of Chicago, I don't know if you know where Streeter, Illinois is. They have a system where they have numbers, and you have so many seconds before it's going to turn red. And it tells you on the, you can see how many seconds. Now, if they are going to have, this red light thing is only to make money. Because I've been driving since 1967. I've never, ever, ever had an accident, ever. And I drove all over the state of Michigan and all over the state of Illinois since 1977, all over the state of Illinois, all over Chicago, and never, ever, ever had an accident.
Well, knock on wood, Susan, and we hope it keeps that way. We thank you so much for calling. Those timers, I think, help, don't
you,
Bill?
That's a better safety measure, isn't it?
Where you can, it counts down till the light turns.
Well, in response to some of these management and oversight issues the manual administration has had on this program, they've started installing some of these pedestrian countdown meters. When I talk to safety experts, though, they say that's not a substitute for a yellow light. That's for pedestrians. And when a driver has so much to think about that they're not thinking about it consciously, but under the surface, there you got so many decisions to make. Looking around for a pedestrian countdown meter should not be one of them. You're supposed to be looking at your light and focused on the yellow light. So instead of raising the yellow light times, they've started installing these pedestrian countdown meters, and people can see them from way down the street, and they can see, but that's not what they're designed to do.
Right.
But I think they help the driver big time, because if I see it's 20 seconds, I know that I can get into the middle of the intersection and wait my turn. If it's 2 seconds, I'll stay behind the line and wait.
Right, but that's not something a driver is supposed to be looking at.
I look at everything.
I know.
I do my nails.
Wendy has statistics, charts, and graphs, and she'll look.
But you said it yourself, David. You can see it from down the street, and sometimes not every intersection has the light suspended above it. A lot of times the light is right where that flashing number is, so I find it helpful.
Great job on this. Even though it's bad news, you did a wonderful job of reporting it. And what are you working on now, David? What's coming up?
Well, stay tuned. We're looking at the speed camera program. So that's a package.
Excellent.
I got one of those. I will confess. But it was actually just a warning. And it said, we clocked you at going such and such in a school zone. Your record's good.
Oh.
This is a warning. Don't do it again.
That's not
so
bad.
I take a different route to work now.
Everybody gets a free pass. Free pass on the speeding.
Good. We'll take it. David Kidwell, investigative political reporter for your Chicago Tribune. Thanks,
Thank
David.
You.
Appreciate
Great
it.
Great to be here. Thanks.
News is next. Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thank you very much. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Earlier in the show, less than an hour ago, I made a comment about coupons, and I said I feel like I'm becoming my own grandparents just for saying that I've used a coupon at a restaurant. One of the Italian restaurants near me does a thing every month where they give you online a coupon for that particular month, and then you save 15% at the restaurant. And I always used to make fun of my grandparents. Anytime we'd go anywhere, they'd look in their purse or wallet, and they would find some coupon for something, sometimes for 5 cents off of something. And I would just say, is it worth the effort of carrying, clipping that and carrying it around to save 5 cents?
Quit
it
being a hypocrite.
Seemed crazy to me.
Well, 5 cents is not going to help you, although back in the day, Billy.
That was real money back then, 5 cents.
Don't you, when you order something online, I don't want to give the my sister's birthday is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a list put together, and I went and Googled the place that I was shopping at, promo code.
Right.
And I save 20%. I do that every time
feels
I buy
something.
Feels
good when you do that. Well, that's I guess that's our generation's version of what I remember.
Clipping coupons.
My
do
mom,
you say coupons? Because I say coupons.
I go back and forth. I do both.
I'm bohemian.
My mom used to spend hours sometimes. You know, the Sunday paper would come, and she would just spend hours. Oh, you guys like Weiler's drink mix? Look, we can save 10 cents on Weiler's. So she would clip that coupon and then another one, and she had a little folder she would bring with her to the store.
The little tiny accordion folder.
Yeah, the accordion folder, and she would have, they were all in either alphabetical order or the order in which she either liked or didn't like the product.
Categories, Bill.
It was categories.
Cleaning,
right,
house,
right.
You know,
right.
Rice and pasta.
Right.
Cat food.
Yes.
Well, and we didn't
pets.
Have a cat. We would just buy, my mom would go, look, it's on sale. We'd be remiss if we didn't purchase cat food. We have a coupon. But then she'd go to Las Vegas twice a year and throw money away like it was nothing, you know? And
maybe she had a coupon.
She did have a coupon, right? She would scan the coupon on the slot machine. At BuzzFeed, they have put together things that if you visited your grandmother, you definitely saw these things every time you visited your grandmother. Can I tell you what they are? And then you tell me if you think these are legit or not, illegitimate or not.
What?
You're legitimate or not. Your grandmother would tend to have, I know mine did anyway, she would have a big tin of like Maurice Linnell cookies or butter cookies, but inside the tin was never really cookies. It was sewing supplies.
Oh, my God, yes.
Right? Your grandmother had that
Royal
going too?
That Royal Dansk?
Yeah.
The blue tin with the Swedish cookies, and
it was
always bobbins and needles.
Yeah.
And you are 100% right.
Every grandmother had that. My grandmother had a, like, next to her refrigerator, every time we went there, was a tin of chocolate pretzels. And you go, oh, chocolate pretzels, this is the best. But then when you opened it, it was sewing supplies.
You give me the best idea because my sewing box is way too small, so I am going to get
a
tin
of
tin.
Some cookies.
You just brought back a really sweet memory for me.
Yeah, everybody's grandmother had those. How about these? These are candies. They're hard candies because we're talking about your grandmother here, and they look like strawberries. They're shaped just like strawberries.
And the wrapper looks like a strawberry.
Yeah, the wrapper is shaped like a strawberry.
With the green on top.
Yep, every grandmother had those.
They weren't good.
Not as good as they should have been. Not as good. My grandmother also, in addition to those candies, always had an assortment of, they looked like slices of fruit. You had orange, you had lime, you had lemon, there was a red one. And they were supposed to taste like fruit, but they just tasted kind of like gel. They were colored
fruit
gel.
Slices.
Fruit slices.
But they taste like a chuckle, be honest.
Yeah.
But they were prettier.
Yeah, yeah.
My grandfather always had hard candy because he was trying to quit smoking and did, so he would always have those coffee candies.
Oh, right.
And I just grabbed them and ate them because it's like, oh, I can get candy from Nino. But it wasn't good candy.
Never good.
But
nope.
You hear candy, you're going to kind of eat it as a kid and then talk yourself into liking
it.
And those red anise candies that weren't really good either.
Yeah. And I know that I'm not taking a shot at the grandma community.
And butterscotch.
But grandmothers think that the kids will like these. I'll buy these for the kids. They'll like these. But the kids don't like those.
No, they buy them for themselves.
I think so.
And they all have dentures, so they're not going to break a tooth on them.
Right. If you visited your grandmother, you probably noticed that she had what they're calling the first television ever invented. This was a giant TV the size of a widescreen TV, but it didn't have any of the features of your widescreen TVs of today. It was in a big console. Mm-hmm. It usually had an antenna on top of it.
Wooden legs. It was in a cabinet.
Right.
But it was all connected.
The channel, the circle that had the channels on it was almost always broken.
Yeah, that's why you had pliers next to the TV.
Always.
That worked every time.
Yep, so true. Your grandmother probably had this, Wendy. I know mine did. A cabinet filled with things that you can never touch. There were glass doors on it, and behind it would be various sorts of china or maybe some nice silverware. Or I know my grandmother had a figure of a woman. It was like a grayish-blue figure of a woman in a strange pose.
Yadro. That's a yadro.
Is that called a yadro?
If they're gray and blue and white. Yeah. Yeah.
A strange pose with one hand behind her and one in front of her.
It was the Heisman Trophy.
Did
girl.
She win the Heisman? I didn't realize that's what it was.
Yadro did a special edition.
The Heisman woman. Right, that's what it was.
Yeah, that's yeah. They call that a curio cabinet, and you're so curio as to what's in there,
right.
But they won't let you touch it.
Right.
My grandmother and aunt collected spoons from every state they went to.
Oh, that's nice.
Like, it wasn't really. It hung on the wall as a display, like little tiny collectible spoons. And it, like, you'd look at it for a while and go, oh, that's cool. They
right.
went to Missouri and Tennessee and Colorado.
So it was only the states that they had visited. They didn't care about getting all 50. It's just
well,
we were
I think
there.
Ultimately they got all
oh,
50.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
That's not bad.
So good for them.
That's very good for them. Maybe that's what the Yadro woman was pointing at. Like, look over there. It's spoons from all 50 states. Thank you, Yadro lady. I didn't know what that was.
L-L-A-D-R-O.
And is that the name of the designer?
Yeah.
Is that the style?
That's what it is. There were Hummel figurines that were, I think, done in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of those. They were brightly colored.
Mm-hmm.
Girls had like a little, maybe an orange hat on with a green skirt. And they had various, maybe a girl looking at a little bird.
Right.
They were very colorful. But
yep.
The Yadros are always in that gray and blue and white.
Now, there's variations on this because some of your grandmothers may have had what I always call the cottage series. I want to say the guy's name is David Rose that designs these. They're just like fairy tale looking cottages. So a grandmother might have two or three of those in that curio cabinet as well. Do you remember those at all? They were like very whimsical looking cottages, very miniature small cottages.
My grandmother had a teapot that looked like a cottage.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of... almost like little bricks
yeah.
were on it.
Yeah, yeah. And then some grandmothers might also have the Precious Moments series.
Really?
Do you remember those at
yeah.
all?
Yeah,
those were popular for a little while.
Little girls had those.
Yeah, sometimes. But I know some grandmothers. One of my friend's grandmothers had
you're big with
about
grandmothers.
100. Oh, I love the grandmas. here's another thing that you probably noticed at your grandmother's place when you visited. There was one room where everything was covered in plastic, and you weren't allowed to sit in there.
We didn't really do the plastic, I have to
no.
be honest with you. My Aunt Phoebe did, but my grandma didn't.
My family didn't, but the woman who lived next door to us, their living room, now they lived next door to us, I would say, for 15 or 16 years. No one was ever in that room. It was like a museum-quality room. And the kids would always say it's for when we have special guests, but they had guests at the house, but even those guests were not allowed in the living room. And everything was covered in plastic.
My mom bought this. She finally redid the front room of our house,
yeah.
the house I grew up in. After our green shag carpeting went out of style,
mm-hmm.
she redid the whole room, and she got this white winged chair
mm-hmm.
With embroidery on it. It was a crewel work that
mm-hmm.
was done. And we always called it the forbidden chair because anytime we sat in it, she'd say, don't sit there.
Right.
It's white. It's going to get dirty. Then why'd you get it? It
I
looks pretty
know.
In the room. But she didn't put plastic on it, but the forbidden chair, we couldn't sit on it.
This woman next door, it was like the joke of the neighborhood. No matter what was going on, there were like they would have parties if the kids would have a graduation party or a first communion. And that room was roped off. And I even said to her one time, what? Will you ever do anything in that room? And she just looked at me like, don't even. And the kids were always like, oh, it's if Elvis comes over, then we'll use the room. But he never came over.
Everybody's saying it's David Winter Cottages.
David Winter. What did I say?
I have no
idea.
I can't remember what I said.
But yeah, it's David Winter Cottages.
And someone wants to say, did your grandmother have a picture of a president on the wall? Because his did. Or hers.
Most grandmothers will have. Here are your three picture options. You get Elvis. You get President Kennedy.
Or Jesus. We had Jesus, I think, or a
right.
cross. Here's another recollection of Grandma. Oh, God. Bill, don't forget the bowl of walnuts
in
the shell and the nutcracker next to the bowl.
Right.
And the York peppermint patties. My grandma didn't have that, but she had the
nuts. Some grandmothers
have
that. My great-grandmother, because my great-grandparents, three of them lived into when I was in high school.
You're lucky.
That's amazing, isn't it? My grandma Bessie in Florida had a full assortment of porcelain fruit that was everywhere. Just there was porcelain fruit, pears, and
lemons, oranges, apples.
No, it's weird because in a climate that supported citrus, you would think they would go with those, but there was a lot of pears. And I'm trying to remember what else there was.
Probably apples. They go well with pears.
There were some apples, right. And my brother and I would always ask if we could play with them, because we didn't want to play with them. My grandma said, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. But what were we going to do with them? Play porcelain fruit market? There was no game to play with porcelain fruit.
Can I take you back in time and ask if you ever did this? My grandmother had a giant Folgers coffee tin filled with pennies.
Yes.
Several of them.
Yeah.
Probably 10 of those coffee cans filled with pennies. And some Saturday afternoons when I'd be there, she'd be like, "Do you want to count my pennies?" And I'd say, "Yes. Oh, yes, please." And I'm telling you, I loved doing it. Sometimes she'd give me the rolls to put them in.
Oh, yeah. That's a good time.
It was really fun.
Yep. My grandfather had one that was filled with pennies and one that was filled with S&H green stamps that I don't think he ever redeemed, because by the time he had enough to buy anything, he was no longer with us.
Oh.
But he had just thousands and thousands of S&H green stamps.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
We have to take a break.
All right, a break, and then more of the things that your grandmother probably had at her house. 312-981-7200 if you'd like to join in. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. For those of you who take it like a Bears fan, Chicago Tribune Sports Plus is for you. Get award-winning sports-only coverage, insights, and perks at chicagotribune.com/sportsplus. Grandma talk.
You are just giving us such good feelings inside thinking about our grandmas. You really are. Marie, are you having some good grandma memory moments? Hi, Marie.
I'm sorry. Yes. My grandparents were both from Poland, and they had a farm up in Wisconsin. So my grandmother had a room that was like a living room area. Everything was covered in this blue material that had, and I don't even know what they're called anymore, but the only thing I could think of is bangles, but it was all crocheted.
Oh, nice.
Ooh, fancy.
That must have looked beautiful.
And then she had a table that she did all the crocheting.
Yeah.
That was covered with crochet, and it had every picture of almost every saint in the world.
Really?
And then it had a couple pictures of the kids.
Yeah.
Mostly saints, though, and some of the kids.
Right.
Right. And then the on another wall was an old piano, which I don't know if they brought from Poland or not, but I remember sitting there and picking out songs, you know, playing songs.
Sure.
Trying to play songs.
Yeah.
And nobody was allowed in that room or to play in that room unless the whole family, all the kids, the five kids and all their kids came up, and that was the only time they were allowed in that room.
That forbidden room. Marie, thank you. We have to move along because we need to get all these people in to get their grandma memories, because it's kind of nice. Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
Grandma memory.
Well, I had a Polish grandmother as well, but she had some different items. She had always had a bottle of vodka and a bottle of Cavassier.
Cavassier?
Yes. When we used to go, it was in the cabinet at her house. We would go to church on Sunday, and I was probably 13, 14 years old. We would all go to my grandmother's house after church, and then she would pour everyone a shot, including me.
And how old were you?
Probably 13, 14, 15 years old, around that age.
Aww.
And everyone had to have the shot. And we would all do the shot after church on Sunday afternoon. And, of course, I tell my kids this now, and they're teenagers, and they don't believe it because I'm not doing that.
Well, thank you. That's a lovely little memory. And Brian is going to mention something I think we may all remember. Brian, what did your grandma have?
Was the wooden pig cutting board.
Sure, of course.
Okay.
Yep.
And we don't know where it was after she passed.
Oh.
I still miss it, but the thing is, too, I still have some of her kitchen knives and some of her sharpening stones.
Oh, nice. Always remember her with those. That's beautiful.
That's pretty sweet, Brian. Thank you.
Let me run a couple of these really quickly past you. These are things you definitely saw anytime you went to your grandmother's house. Makeshift Tupperware, and by that I mean these were at one time Fleischmann's containers
or
of margarine.
Cheese.
Or cottage cheese. But your grandmother, like, not unlike MacGyver, figured out that they could also be used as Tupperware containers.
I just read that. How about the leftovers stored in the icebox in old cottage cheese containers?
Right.
Someone just texted that.
Yeah.
My grandma made her own spaghetti sauce. She had six sisters that all had their own sauce, and mm-hmm. they wouldn't share the secret ingredients. They all had like a little something different,
mm-hmm.
and that's where she froze them in the little cottage yep. cheese containers. Or Cool Whip.
Yeah,
those
always,
work as well.
Cool Whip will always work. Your grandmother probably also had magnets on her refrigerator that were shaped like various fruit. Did yours? My grandmother had those. You had a grape, you had a pineapple, you had an orange, some bananas. And she would put her doctor's appointments up on there. So she would keep those.
I still do that, don't
you? Do you
do
that now?
Don't you put stuff on the fridge?
I don't think I do. No, we don't really. Sometimes pictures, just some pictures of what's inside the refrigerator so we don't have to open the refrigerator. It's easier for
and
us.
And what's with your grandma having the glass fruit and the fruit magnets?
Well, that was my great-grandmother.
Oh, okay.
But then my grandmother had the fruit magnets.
Because we had vacation magnets. Wherever
oh,
they
yeah.
went, that's where
yeah.
it would be on there.
And then I'll give you one more really quickly. Somewhere in your grandmother's house or apartment, she had a stationary bike, even though she never used it.
Yeah, we had
right?
one, too.
Yeah.
Everybody had that.
They give you one when you become
comes with
a
the
grandmother.
House.
Right. They just hand you a stationary bike and they say, please never use this. We'll take a quick break and then we've got more show for you. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. And in studio with us, two guests. Jill Weinberg is the Midwest director of the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Mally Rutkoff is the daughter of two Holocaust survivors. Her mother was an Auschwitz survivor. Her father survived by hiding during the war. Ladies, thank you both for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bill and Wendy.
Thank you so much. I knew that there was a museum here in the North Shore, Holocaust Museum. Where is that?
In Skokie, Illinois.
In Skokie. I want to go visit that. I'm Catholic, and I grew up in Brookfield, and there weren't very many Jewish people around.
Yeah.
And I know what we learned in school, and I'm shocked and appalled when I hear this stuff, but to see something at these museums, I can't even imagine that.
Let's talk about the Washington, D.C. Museum for a little bit and what's happening this weekend, because this is very big news. Go ahead.
This weekend will be a first-time gathering of children of Holocaust survivors at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
For two solid days, the museum scholars, teachers, experts will talk to us about our experiences during growing up with people who survived an unbelievable atrocity and had the courage and the determination to rebuild families, and we are those children.
Was the propensity, and I know that every story is different, but for the survivors who lived through this horrible, horrible event, was the propensity to talk about it or to not want to talk about it as their life progressed?
It varied from family to family. My mom had a tattoo on her arm, so I knew very young that that meant that she was different than my friends' mothers who didn't have those.
Yeah.
What I learned mostly came as a child from listening to her tell the stories to her American neighbors and friends who were not survivors.
It's just so, I can't even imagine it. And explain the tattoo.
The Nazis tattooed men and women and children, and their numbers usually indicated what concentration camps, slave labor camps that they were with.
When your mother would recount stories of what had happened to her when she was younger, it's so emotional. How was she able to get through these stories without breaking down, or did she break down?
You know, I would remember hearing her cry at nights when she believed we were sleeping
yeah.
and struggled with the loss of her parents and siblings and extended families and way of life. But I believe that she and my dad really wanted us to grow up to be regular kids. They wanted us to live a life aware of what they had lost, but not staying in the darkness with
yeah.
it.
And it seems back in those times, no one really went into their innermost feelings and revealed that to people.
Well, Wendy, it's a great observation, because not only has, over the years, the awareness of survivors changed. In the early years when survivors came, our community wanted them to get on with life. They believed that the horrors of what they had endured was over, and it was time for them to build a life. My parents were liberated when they were both 22 years old in different places. So when they came here, they were in their 20s, and they were eager to get back to a new, normal, free way of life. So they did. They brushed themselves off. They got jobs. They saved money. They wanted a home and children, which to me is one of the most incredible parts, that they, after what they saw and endured and lost, they had the confidence to go ahead and believe in raising a family.
Seems like a pretty scary world that they saw, and it would be scary to bring children into it.
Absolutely. And over the years, as for survivors, as time progressed, we became aware of what they lived through and what they endured, and then in many cases, what the survivors have added to our world. Many of them have been successful in business and education and culture, and we look back now and realize that on top of how they rebuilt their lives, often being the only one of an extended family to be part of that.
And you wonder, with all the people that perished, if one of those survivors maybe was the one person who could have found a cure for cancer or something. You never know, and you always wonder.
You know, more than a million children perished during the Holocaust. What would one of those lives have meant? So by coming to the museum this weekend with this group of 125 children, some partners and spouses, are going to study what the museum is dedicating its mission to, and that is how they preserve the memory, how they teach generations to come. And one of the tremendous assets of the museum is how they use this voice to influence current day genocides that are going on.
Kim Gordon, who works up in the news department, is a friend of both of yours, and she was explaining to me how in many cases the children of the Holocaust survivors were learning more about their parents, things that they didn't know about their own parents, through this, correct?
My own experience. I've been active in the Midwest office of the United States Holocaust Museum here in Chicago for over 20 years. And a few years ago, the International Tracing Service, which was documents that the Nazis held closely, released its information, and the U.S. Holocaust Museum is one of the repositories of those documents. And Jill Weinberg, who's here with me, asked me to put in my mother's tattoo number and let's see what came up. And in 2 days, the museum was able to find for me the names and places and dates of all the camps, work, slave labor camps and ghettos that my mother had been in from 1940 to 45.
They kept very extensive records.
Immaculate records. Yeah. And all we needed was her tattoo number off her arm. But my mom died when I was 19 and she was only 49, so I couldn't really ask her about that.
Yeah.
So I went to a jewelry box that I have of hers with a piece of paper, and in it, written in her hand, were the names and the dates of places. But I didn't know that. I just thought they were things she wanted to remember.
Yeah.
They matched what the museum had in its records.
You think about, you know, now we know about post-traumatic stress disorder and our veterans, yesterday being Veterans Day, they come home, they need help. Imagine the help that these survivors needed when they came home and didn't have anything.
No, because as you said, Wendy, that was a generation where you dusted yourself off and you went on and you built your life.
I always wonder when somebody is that close to something so devastating, like the concentration camps and the Holocaust, how you find joy in other things in life. Was your mother able to rebound enough to where things genuinely made her happy after experiencing this?
Absolutely.
She was, good.
The survivor community I grew up in universally, both my parents and others, found joy in their children. They were probably, could be accused of being overprotective, but understandably so. They wanted the success of that we enjoyed were things that reflected on them. You know, it's funny when you use the word children. We're people now in our 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. But yet we were the hope that they brought out of this horrible experience. And from us come new generations. And so their lives mattered because of that.
Do you think in any way, shape, or form, you seemed somewhat surprised that they came home and wanted to have children, but to see all those children perish, was that their way of recreating life again?
Absolutely, and of building their own families. I mean, many people who survived were the only one person from a large extended family, and so this gave them family again.
Jill Weinberg is the Midwest director of the U.S. Holocaust Museum. Jill, let's talk about the experience of the museum itself. When people visit there, what are they seeing exactly?
The fact that well over 90% of the visitors to the museum are not Jewish is one of the most extraordinary aspects of it, that we're hearing from Mally a really unique experience of the children of survivors going on this trip and having this very, very personal experience. But for the masses of the visitors to the museum, they are not familiar with this subject matter, certainly not familiar personally with this. And how do you take that visitor to the through the museum and help them to understand the enormity of this chapter in our history of these crimes? And so from the time the visitor enters the museum, they're hearing the voice of the American soldier, because this is an American institution, helping the visitor to understand, why is this museum so important to American history? Why is this located in our nation's capital? Why is this on the Mall in Washington, D.C.? And so the first thing that the visitor hears is the American soldier saying how unprepared they were themselves for what they were about to see, and then the doors open and the first sight that the viewer sees is of the concentration camp. And then it walks the visitor through the history from before the war, because none of this happened with concentration camps. It is helping people to understand the steps that took place long before we got to killing centers.
Sure.
And what did you say the percentage was of people that weren't Jewish who wanted to find out? Because that's why I'd like to go. I'm not familiar with this the way you are.
And the fact that over 90% of the visitors to the museum are not Jewish is truly significant. And that statistic has risen right from the beginning. So when this museum opened 23 years ago, the vast numbers of Jews who have a incredible investment in this have visited. And of course, when you think statistically about the numbers of people in this country, it is quite interesting that those numbers have grown. The other thing that has grown as well is the number of international visitors to the museum, that you have over 100 heads of state that have visited the museum. And this museum, which started as a national museum, also is very, very involved and invested in international issues at this point as well.
I'm guessing just a simple walk through the museum is incredibly emotional for a lot of people, isn't it?
For everyone, I bet.
Absolutely.
In different ways.
And we used to define the visitor to the museum as the person who actually walked through the doors of the museum.
Yeah.
And that is over 20 million people who have walked through the doors of the museum. But in fact, and it's close to 2 million visitors every single year have walked through the doors of the museum. But now we've redefined the visitor, because so many people, when this museum opened, there wasn't a website, there wasn't the internet. And now, because the museum has such an incredible website, and the website is in 15 different languages, it allows the visitor to be that person, whether they're in Europe, whether they're in Egypt, to be able to visit this museum and find the answers to their questions.
We're going to talk more about the big event, which is this weekend, the second generation mission trip to Washington, D.C. for children of survivors. It's taking place this weekend. I know this is short notice because this weekend is coming up in just a day or so. But if people want to get involved, this is the first time you've done this. You hope to do this more times in the future.
But people are texting, how can I get involved? How can I go with? Is there a website to go to?
Yes, there is. USHMM.org is the website for the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. It is an extraordinary website where people can find out how to visit the museum in Washington. People can find out by going to the Midwest page. People can find out about all of the activities that are happening locally in Chicago. We have many events that are free and open to the public that are constant educational opportunities to update people on what's going on. Teachers who want to learn about how to access information about how to teach the Holocaust can go to the website. It is vast in terms, Mally mentioned about the museum's focus on current day issues and looking at early warning signs of other genocides.
Yeah.
So people can and must access that website to see the vast, vast information that
exists. It's USHMM.org. That's your best bet to get to the website. And then there's tabs to click on for events and second generation if you want to know more about this particular event. Let's come back and talk more with Jill Weinberg, the Midwest director of the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and Mally Rutkoff, the daughter of two Holocaust survivors. We're at 312-981-7200 if you want to jump in. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. All right, two guests in studio with us right now. Jill Weinberg is the Midwest director of the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Mally Rutkoff is the daughter of two Holocaust survivors. Her mother was at Auschwitz, where she survived, thankfully. Her father survived just by hiding out. You started to tell us all a story about when you visit. You bring a picture of your mother with you, don't you?
I carry a photo that she had taken right after the war in the displaced persons camp. And she holds her arm with the tattoo number and points at it as if to say, this is my mark forever.
Yeah.
And certainly she's not alone. They were definitely marked.
Yeah.
And men and women, children, and a mark that stayed with them for their whole lives.
We got a text here that I would like to share with you ladies. Bill and Wendy took a group of eighth graders to Washington, D.C. many years ago. Loved how they were given a little book that had information about a person who was in a concentration camp during the war. It wasn't until the end of the tour that the students were able to find out what happened to their person. Can your guests talk a little about that?
So when each visitor walks into the museum, they are given an ID card, and it is an actual person who went through the Holocaust. And it is for the men, they may take a man, for a woman, and it talks about where that person is from. And at each different point in the museum, they are tracked through the paces of what that person experienced. And the concept is that when you think about the 6 million Jews who were murdered during the Holocaust, it is very difficult for anyone to fathom what those numbers mean. But if we can begin to identify with that one visitor that we take with us, that we are literally traveling through this experience with, that is much more able to be comprehended. And many, many, many people tell me that years later, they are still holding on to those ID cards because that is one of their strongest connections to the museum.
Wendy, you were just questioning bringing the boys there. I'm guessing mostly because Dylan is a little bit younger, but it is one of those things, even though it can be a very, very hard lesson for anybody, not just a kid, to see what went on, it's such an important lesson.
It is. It's something they need to know about, and the schools don't really go in depth, you know? Another text, my father was Jewish, family never talked about that time. I'm in my 50s and unfortunately know nothing of what happened to my family from that terrible time, and I'm sure there's a lot of people in that situation.
And the museum will be happy, just like in my experience, to take the bits of information they have and go through these documents that came out of Germany just a few years ago and search and be able to look and see what information can be shared,
right,
that gives an indication of where their parents might have been, where relatives might have perished, what might have happened to extended family. Sometimes there isn't anything, but quite often there is.
It's not unusual, as this person wrote in, for families not to talk about this subject matter, and clearly we can understand that. And as someone who's been working very closely with this material and with these people since even before the museum was built, Mally spoke earlier about how her family did, how her parents did speak somewhat, but many, many, many survivors' children will tell you that they know nothing as this person did, and how frustrating it is.
And so they didn't want to ask either. I mean, I know they were curious as a child, but you didn't want to bring up painful information from your parents.
Exactly. You knew it was too painful, and there are times when actually Holocaust survivors have started talking to me because I am safe, but they didn't want to burden their own children, and their own children have said, I can't believe my mother told you that. She won't tell me because it's too difficult. And Mally said all they wanted was for their children to have a normal life. Exactly. And what's interesting is over the years, as Holocaust survivors have aged, many who didn't speak, many did start to speak later in life.
Sure.
A result of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, a result of Schindler's List, a result of aging, a result of actually far more interest in this subject matter than there ever was. I mean, in the schools, it's being taught now in a way that it wasn't taught in the schools. Books are being published now, many more than ever before. So a little time, a little distance, a little healing, a little success of one's children, all of those things have allowed this subject matter to emerge. But still, to this day, there are many people like that person
and
who said that.
I would add just to say that one of the things that was critically important to survivors is that their stories, their experiences not die out with them.
Yeah.
And that we as children, their descendants and our children and others, continue to share the story. And even by having us on today,
so
you
important.
Give voice to that.
Thank you both for
second
being here.
Second generation leadership mission.